Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Back surgery, weight loss surgery, cardiac care, incredibly complex medicine made easy to understand, thanks to the DMC. Join Emory King at DMC.org to see why, when it's serious, go to Detroit. Check out the DMC videos today at DMC.org.
Hey, there you go, from Korn's number one self-titled 1994 debut album. That was one of their big ones, and one of their first, Blind. And before that, their version of Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. It's all been brought to you by Chevy and American Revolution. Thanks for hanging with me. Absolutely Live in Concert is written, produced, and engineered by Donnie Ray. Mixed by Dave Amaya. Additional in-studio engineering by Mike Gagliano, courtesy of WRIF in Detroit. Live recordings by Westwood One Remote Recording and engineered by Biff Dawes and assisted by Doug Fields, Phil Kneebone, and Jay Resnick. Special thanks to the quality control of the Koseo Clan. Absolutely Live in Concert is a presentation of the mighty Westwood One. Your executive producer, Norm Pattis. Hey, I'm your doc, Doug Podell. Until next time, you guys remember to rock till you drop, and I'll see ya.
It was really easy.
It was simple.
Even I can do it.
This year, do your taxes with TurboTax Online. It does all the hard work for you. You just answer simple questions, and it automatically fills in all the right forms. With eFile Plus Direct Deposit, there's no easier way to get your refund.
They made it really easy.
TurboTax. Choose easy. Now get the federal free edition at TurboTax.com. Appropriate for the majority of returns.
My name is Tyson Clark. I'm an officer in the U.S. Navy. I'm also a graduate student in college. Before I took on grad school courses, I navigated courses on submarines and got an advanced degree in responsibility and leadership. The Navy gave me the money I needed for college and the experience I'll use to stay ahead for the rest of my life. And someday soon, I'll own my own business. Ready to find the person in you? Call 1-800-USA-NAVY or go to Navy.com.
Navy, accelerate your life.
I'm Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. Since we were children, we've been told to reach for the stars. It was great advice then. Now it's a great gift. Name a star after someone. For $54 and a call to 800-282-3333, we'll name a star after someone very special to you and send an incredible personalized gift package. The new star name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Call the Star Registry, 800-282-3333. That's 800-282-3333 for the hottest gift.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. Welcome to the broadcast. Jalene Jordan is with me, as usual. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter. Always a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, and we have a special show, because it's all about us.
It's all about you.
Well, you're part of it, too. We said last week that when I had returned from a week's trip to the island of Cuba, that we would do a show this week that... I got a chance to really give a report on what was happening.
Yeah.
The people, the politics, the culture.
What you experienced.
Yeah. Yeah, an incredible tour. In fact, I wanted to say, I know a number of my Canadian travel mates are listening, and I wanted to say a big shout out to them, because they're a big part of it. And I don't think we said that on the interview. Did I? No.
I don't think so, yeah, actually. Yeah.
Some great people talk. You know, I know it's kind of a cliche about bonding and all that, but we really
did.
Well,
you do bond when you travel.
Yeah, yeah. We would all like to go back, too. It was such an incredible experience, and we all learned so much, which, of course, is why I went. Because, well, actually, I'm giving it away. What's going to be? Here's what we're going to do. Here's the format, folks. In about this, I'm not even going to explain why. But in about 10 minutes, we're going to begin this interview that Jalene did with me. She was interviewing me, and I was answering.
Yes.
Yes, I was, indeed.
I was mostly interviewing you.
Yeah, well.
You have the ability, it's amazing, to interview yourself as well. It's a true talent.
I did. Oh, yeah, at one point I remember I said, you ask about labor unions?
Yeah.
Right. But we need about 10 minutes before that. So, actually, this is one of the few times I'm going to say don't call in right now. But because this is going to take about an hour, and I hope you find it interesting, because I certainly found it interesting and informative, which, again, was the purpose of my visit to Cuba.
Right, and then we'll open up the phone lines. We'll talk about that and all the other things that are going on since last Sunday.
Like the economy going in the toilet.
Way down the toilet.
Oh, man. Yeah. But I want to talk about a couple of things, and that'll take us up to when we do this interview. And I just love stuff like this because it intersects with our favorite music, rock and roll, and politics. Yeah. Boston's Tom Scholl, that's the band, Boston, the classic rock band.
More Than a Feeling.
More Than a Feeling. Well, that turned out to be that Mike Huckabee, this far-right-wing evangelical Christian who wants to amend the Constitution of the United States to make it a Christian nation, he's been using Boston's song, More Than a Feeling. And it's at campaign appearances, rallies, and all of that. And Scholl said, hey, man, stop. He sent a letter to the Huckabee campaign. Boston has never endorsed a political candidate, and with all due respect, what a nice man, would not start by endorsing a candidate who is the polar opposite of most everything Boston stands for.
Oh, yeah.
And we're not talking about the city. We're not talking about the city.
The band Boston.
The band Boston.
You know, the 70s, man.
Yeah, wow.
Right.
Totally.
And he also said, by using my song and my band's name Boston, you have taken something of mine and used it to promote ideas to which I am opposed. In other words, I think I've been ripped off, dude.
Really? You got a better account than I do. I don't have that here. But he also said, and it sounded tongue-in-cheek, he said, although I'm impressed that you learned my bass guitar part on More Than a Feeling, I am a Barack Obama supporter.
Yeah, he is.
And it was a bad day for another right-winger, John McCain, because John Mellencamp said, hey, why are you playing my songs?
Two of his songs, not just one.
What was the other? He played Our Country.
Our Country and Pink Houses.
Oh, okay.
As well. And, you know, when I heard these, the little that I have watched this on TV, because it makes me absolutely insane when I do, I thought, Mellencamp, please tell me that he's not one of these right-wing wackos.
Well, McCain turns out to be sort of a lame ball like Reagan. Remember Reagan really liked Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen? Yeah. Totally misunderstanding the song. He thought it was this great patriotic anthem.
Yes.
And, of course, the lyrics by Springsteen are much darker, much darker. Well, here, in this from the Associated Press, it may be Our Country, but it's a John Mellencamp song. When the liberal rocker found out songs are being played by events for Republican John McCain's presidential campaign, Mellencamp's publicist sent a letter that questioned the campaign's playlist. He's, quote, are you sure you want to use his music to promote Senator McCain's efforts, according to the letter? Logic says that the facts might prove to be an embarrassment were they to be circulated widely. The letter explained that Mellencamp was a liberal who had supported Democrat John Edwards, who recently dropped out of the race. Publicist Bob Merlis said Mellencamp told him the situation made him uncomfortable, and he couldn't imagine McCain would want to be associated with him. Merlis said, you know, here's a guy talking about Mellencamp. Wait a minute. No, they're talking about McCain. You know, here's a guy running around saying, I'm a true conservative. Well, if you're such a true conservative, why are you playing songs that have a very populist pro-labor message written by a guy, John Mellencamp, who would find no argument if you characterized him as left of center? I love it.
Yeah, I love it, too. And I didn't even realize that Hillary's using Celine, You and I, which is kind of weird. But Obama, I didn't even realize this because I don't watch all of this rallying on television. Obama frequently blares U2's City of Blinding Lights. Huh?
Okay. I don't know.
No, just picked a cool band.
Yeah, they did. You did. Well, wait a minute. Oh, yeah. That reminds me. You can find both these items about John Mellencamp and the band Boston at my website, Peter Werbe, peterwerbe.com. And I do most of the work on that site, and I always write real quickly, and I read it back real quickly, and then I see it a day later, and I go, oh, my God. I'm sorry. Oh, my Gaia. Oh, my Gaia. I see these errors that have been made. And so maybe you don't care either. I shouldn't say either, because I care, but maybe you don't care, is what I should say.
Well, I think people are forgiving. You know, back to the music thing, real quick, one final note.
Okay, you're as ADD as I am.
I have to say this, I used to love Van Morrison.
Yeah?
And ever since I found out that it's Laura Bush's favorite artist, and they played at one of their inaugurations, I've just never been able to go there again. Isn't it sad?
It's, I don't know.
It's sad.
So what's it? What's the song? Moon Dance. It's a wonderful night for a moon dance.
That's a good one.
I know.
Yeah.
My wife told me never sing in public, Pete. So
Into the Mystic, I think,
yeah,
is another
that's great.
One.
I still. You know, I'm willing to.
I don't know.
I mean, I like Ted Nugent's music, even though it's hard for me to think that this guy is such a right-wing whack job.
To move to Crawford.
To move to Crawford. Yeah, he really timed it badly. But, you know, and he doesn't call himself the Motor City Madman anymore. He calls himself the Texas Wild Man.
that kind of bums me out.
It does.
Because, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Know your roots. You are the Motor City Madman.
Yeah, he is
even
a madman.
Even if you wear flag shirts. Remember that one?
What a doofus. Anyway, back to my website, peterwerby.com. Here's what I'd like some of you to do, and some people love to do that, and that is when you find errors there, write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I go through it and I go, I wonder how long this link has been dead, right?
Well, I mean, your website is quite involved, Peter.
It is, yeah, it's a total mess. It's everything under the sun. But let's go back to John McCain a little.
Okay.
One of the things that gave him such, I don't know, dignity, majesty, whatever, that he was a POW during the Vietnam War.
Well, how long was it? It was several years.
Yeah.
6 years or something like that.
Oh, I thought you meant how long ago it was. Well, some people are saying, could you get over it? You know, it was like 50 years ago or something.
But we get it. We get that he did it. He's been praised over
42.
And over again, right, Peter? People have praised him over and over again. We get it.
Think about this. He was bombing, essentially, an unarmed civilian population that had no capacity, except with some anti-aircraft fire that brought him down. So, I mean, he wasn't exactly... I mean, I guess it's pretty heroic to be flying over enemy territory and all that. But as we know, he was part of the military machine that wound up killing somewhere up to 3 million Vietnamese civilians. So his captors were a little pissed off. But still, it doesn't give them any right to have mistreated him or any prisoners. In fact, it is to be absolutely condemned. Any mistreatment of prisoners anywhere. So I don't get it how people are so condemnatory of what the Vietnamese did to American prisoners, people that had killed thousands of civilians, still doesn't give anyone the permission to take out their anger on an unarmed person.
Yeah.
An unarmed person in war should never be injured, ever. But, well, I'll be way off in that. So how is it okay to do what the United States does at Guantanamo or in Afghanistan? What's the Bagram? Yeah, Bagram Air Base or at Abu Ghraib. I just don't get this. And I don't get how in the vote, 51-45, that the Senate voted to ban waterboarding and other torture forms of torture that have been used by the CIA. And in fact, you know, these soft liberals, you know, that you want to be easy on the terrorists. Actually, what they're doing is saying that the interrogation methods would be limited to what techniques are permitted by the Army Field Manual.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. The Army Field Manual has rules and regulations for what can be done to captured prisoners. And you would think these guys are in the field. They're the ones that are going to suffer if something goes wrong in military intelligence, yet they have restrictions against us. And we've said before, waterboarding has been prosecuted by the United States. The United States has prosecuted its own soldiers in other wars, going back to the war against the Filipinos in 100 and some years ago, for waterboarding prisoners, for waterboarding prisoners in Vietnam. These were U.S. soldiers that were court-martialed for this, and the Japanese were prosecuted as war criminals for waterboarding United States prisoners of war during World War II. So John McCain voted against this bill. So he essentially is saying it's okay because he says, wait a minute, I think there's a quote here, we always supported allowing the CIA to use extra measures.
Extra measures.
Yeah, so maybe the Vietnamese are saying about John McCain when they are rifle-butting him around, it's okay for us to use extra measures on John McCain. Because it's the old thing, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And, these people are...
I know. And what's
I'm just looking at your T-shirt. Is this...
It says, stop bitching, start a revolution. Let's go, people.
Jelaine Jordan, my producer.
And what does your shirt say?
Each of us got revolutionary shirts.
We do.
But mine's crazy.
Yours is,
The revolution will not be motorized.
Will not be motorized.
What the hell does that mean?
I don't know.
Well, actually, my travel mates in Cuba.
Is it an environmental thing?
Yeah, it is. Okay. It's from, I don't know if I can take this off exactly without, what does it say on the back?
Citizens Environment Alliance. Wow.
There's a good folks. Those are the folks that, in Windsor, that I used to host every year, this river cruise.
We
didn't do it last year. Let's do it again, folks. But
yeah, I'd like to go on that.
So,
River Rouge?
No.
Oh, different
Detroit.
One. Different
one.
Okay.
The Detroit River.
All right.
Yeah. But so we both, and actually my Canadian travel mates on my trip to Cuba will recognize the shirt because since my luggage never arrived in Cuba.
You wore it every day?
Well, I wore it for more than most of them would like and I would like, I'm
and that,
sure.
You know, that's something we didn't talk about in the interview that we're going to play here in about a minute.
Yeah.
Is that your luggage was lost and you've never gotten
it
back.
I've never gotten it back. Right.
Yeah.
But they kindly, I think maybe just because after I wore it for a few days, they're going, you know, we're in a bus together. So they think, get a little ripe, Pete. it was just out of their generosity.
That was very nice of them.
And it actually became the trip joke. So should we, I'm nervous about doing, I don't know why. I'm nervous about pressing the button.
About the interview?
The interview.
Yeah, you were nervous to be interviewed by me.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
You're a tough interview.
Well, right.
And particularly
when
I interviewed myself.
That was the best part.
So here's the deal, folks. I'm Peter Werby. Jalene Jordan is with me here on WRIF. And what we're going to do, this is two parts. We're going to play this, I think it's 23 minutes. First part, and then we're going to take a break and come back with a little more. So phone calling probably isn't the best right now, but up around a little after midnight Eastern or -5 GMT. I love that. We'll be back and get your calls. So here it is. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you as usual. And as Monty Python used to say, and now for something completely different. Usually I do the interviewing, but we're turning the tables a bit today. Jalene Jordan, my longtime producer, friend, co-host in some of my broadcasting endeavors, is joining me here in the studios. Jalene, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, Peter, thank you for having me. This is very special.
It is. You're going to interview me, and can you believe it? I'm actually a little nervous.
I know. I'm feeling it, too.
Well, we should tell people that Jalene is going to be interviewing me about my recent trip to Cuba, where I visited the island February 2nd through February 9th, and I'm back. At one point, it was 90 degrees in Cuba, and then I came back to Toronto, and it was zero. So when I came back, it was 90 degrees colder. But this was not a a pleasure trip or a vacation. It was a working endeavor that is. Well, actually, I'm taking this away. You got some questions for me, don't you, Jalene?
I absolutely do. Yeah. And, you know, it's welcome back and glad to have you back in the United States. But when I told people while you were gone to Cuba, you know, when I told them where you were going, first they said, is he crazy?
Yeah.
And second, they said, how can he travel to Cuba? And I thought we could start with those two questions. First of all, are you crazy?
Well, I don't know if I'll address that one. That'll be up to the listener to figure that. But I'm not crazy in the sense that of going to the island that millions of people do every year.
Absolutely.
Mostly from Canada and from Europe.
I think that's a really important something to point out right there, because people look at it as this locked down country, but you can travel. Some people can travel.
Well, there's two ways that Americans can travel. There's lots of restrictions on travel, and there's the Cuba Embargo Act, which forbids American citizens, U.S. citizens, from traveling to Cuba unless they are in two categories. The largest category is what they have to apply for, what's called a special license. And that means if there's a conference having to do with education or any number of events, religious events, that you can apply to the U.S. Department of State, and they will, under certain circumstances, issue a special license for Americans to travel to Cuba. In the case of myself, that I fall in the category of a general license, but because of the United States Constitution, its First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press, it means they can't control journalists such as myself. So I went there because it is, as you said, or indicated or suggested, a restricted place that people don't know much about, that it's, you can read a lot, and I would suggest that. But having first-hand experience in an island that is portrayed to us as what? a, what did you say, a lockdown,
lockdown
country,
state.
Power-mad dictator, a police state where you look the wrong way and you're jailed, and the people are starving, longing to be free, and are just waiting for the death of Fidel Castro to die when they will enjoy all the benefits of American-style democracy.
And I believe, Peter, that most Americans out there, I don't personally, because I know a little more just by being around you and learning from you, but it's really the opinion of most of Americans, wouldn't you say, what you just described?
I would say so, and maybe we should address some of those. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to be real careful of is that during the 1930s, there was a group in the United States called the Soviet American Friendship League, and they would send people to the Soviet Union, which was an authentic lockdown police state under Stalin, and they would be shown these sort of model villages and model factories, and they would say, oh, this is socialism, this is a wonderful place for people to live, and this is the future. Well, we know the opposite is true. But the tour that I went on was called Off the Beaten Path, and it was put together by an organization from Toronto called Leading Edge Seminars. And they are in contact and were able to organize these tours through the Cuban Ministry of Tourism and saw things that usually you would not be able to. It was a very unique experience for someone who wants to understand the world, partly for myself, but in good part for being able to report it on shows like this or the articles that I intend to write. So one thing that's interesting, I thought, and I have a lot of photographs, which, here, can you see them all? No, obviously we can't. But when you arrive, we flew from Toronto to Holguín, Cuba, which is in the eastern sector of the country. The country's big. It's like 766 miles long. So this is not a little teeny island like Antigua or something like that.
Yeah, I've flown over it.
It's a big country.
It is.
Indeed, it's a big country. People think like Jamaica's big. This is, you know, way big. Anyway, so you fly into the airport and it says Socialismo o Muerte, socialism or death.
Ah.
You know, big slogan right there at the airport. And the next thing you see is a truck that says Cuba Catering. And in many ways, to me, this sort of was emblematic of what the Cuban country, culture, and politics facing. I mean, this idealism and whether or not it has gotten major frayed around the edges and just turned out to be a racket for the rulers, the way a lot of the communist countries in Eastern Europe and in Asia had become. The idea of that they have to have at least some aspects of a capitalist economy in order to survive in a capitalist world. And that became writ large throughout our journey there, which we went all around the country. We were supposed to go to Guantanamo at an overlook over the U.S. naval base there and take photographs. But the Cuban government had recently closed it because the American government was accusing the Cubans of allowing Al-Qaeda operatives to take photographs there.
Oh,
so, we couldn't go. But we went to the city of Guantanamo, which is nowhere, well, it's in the same region, but I don't know, 50, 60, 70 kilometers away from the naval base. Naval base in itself is a pretty interesting thing, that there is this foreign naval base on this island. And it was, I think, 1903 when the United States got it. Remember, there was a Spanish-American War. This was Teddy Roosevelt charging up San Juan Hill. Actually, we stayed in a hotel that was on San Juan Hill in Santiago de Cuba.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I was talking about Americans thinking of Cubans and the Cuban population as prisoners. Who has the prisoners?
Well, there is Amnesty International says that there is 300 political prisoners, which is absolutely unacceptable. It is unacceptable for any country to have political prisoners. And it's, for instance, a debate about how many prisoners are political in the United States. I mean, you don't get put in prison in the United States for saying the views that you and I say frequently. You might be able to. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether if you're just a loudmouth like I am, do you get put away. I know that if you tried to form an independent trade union, you're out of there. You're going to wind up in jail. I mean, because there's a slogan there. I can't remember it in Spanish, but essentially it says, inside the revolution, everything, outside the revolution, nothing. But the question is, who gets to make that decision? And that, of course, is the people in the government, the state repressive apparatus, which, and I say that, that phrase, state repressive apparatus, is every nation state has that. Every nation state has armies and police and secret police and what have you. A friend of mine who lived in Holguin, Cuba, said, it's a wonderful country with lots of great things and the government sucks. And and I said, wow. And he said, yeah, sort of like the U.S.
Right, sounds like it. Well, as you go throughout Cuba, do you get the sense that the people are oppressed?
Well, no. And I don't know what it would be like if you went to Stalin's Russia in the 1930s or Hitler's Germany. I mean, we get the idea that the sun never shines, like, say, in Russia and Germany, the 30s. The sun's never shined. There was a Gestapo agent on every corner. You know, you had to say Heil Hitler at every moment. Well, you don't get that impression. And people seemed...
Do they seem happy?
They seem happy. I mean, here's what's happening in Cuba. People aren't starving. They were starving 15 years ago after the Soviet Union collapsed at the end of the 1980s and stopped all the subsidies and bringing in the food. They essentially were... Cuba by the late 1980s was essentially a welfare case for the Soviet Union, and suddenly everything dropped. I mean, they were the Soviet Union was buying all of its sugar at subsidized prices. Suddenly, they've got nothing. I mean, people were severely malnutritioned. Is that the word? Yeah.
Malnourished.
Malnourished. Thank you. That's why I have a producer, folks. Right. By the way, you're listening to the Peter Werby Show. Jalene Jordan, my producer, is interviewing me about my recent trip to Cuba. But since then, they've switched to about 90% organic agriculture. There's food for everyone. You can, when you see people in the streets, and I'm going to put some of my photographs, which aren't there yet, up on my website at peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. And you can look in the streets, for instance, in the city of Guantanamo when we were there, and you see people that they look like Americans. You know, a little bit, the guy's a little bit of a gut hanging over their belts and what have you. The housing, there's enough housing for everyone. A lot of the housing is in deteriorated condition and a real bone of contention, a sore spot for the Cuban people.
Did you get a chance to see that up close?
We looked at some of the, we had an amazing tour guide, Roberto, who knew everything about everything. We called him Senor Google.
that's great.
Yeah. And he really knew everything about everything and beyond even Cuba. And he said that, oh, this housing looks shabby, although inside they really take care of it. But there's this sort of ethos that if you, like, fix up your house on the outside, you're going to look like you're trying to be, you know, hoity-toity or something like that. And
better
I thought,
than the others.
Yeah. And, you know, first thought it was, I don't believe this. You know, I thought it was just an excuse for the poor housing situation. And because there is a housing crisis in Cuba, there's no doubt about it, and the Cubans will be the first to say that, the Cuban people, the Cuban government. But actually, then we saw, like, we were in this city of Baracoa in the eastern sector of Cuba, and you could look into people's houses, and all the floors are tile, and they don't appear to have any carpeting, maybe because it's a damp climate.
Yeah, hurricane areas.
Well, that's another thing, too. I hadn't thought of that. But everything is tiled. And inside, they were small houses. They looked neat. They had furniture and little television. And, I mean, for an average middle-class American, or even a working-class American, we'd say, whoa, this is not the way we want to live. But this is a poor country with poor people in it. And probably the Cuban people, the Cuban poor particularly, live better than the poor anywhere in the world. I mean, they have this low infant mortality rate. The infant mortality rate in the city of Detroit is, what is it? I can't even do the math. 12 times that of Cuba's.
Well, that is very telling. And it's because they have health care.
Free health care for everyone. They produce the largest number of doctors of anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. They train doctors from other countries. In some cases, like they train doctors, they send doctors to Venezuela, that Venezuela sends refined oil and gasoline to Cuba. The average, what do they call it, life expectancy is over 70 years. There's almost 100% literacy rate, which is greater than the United States and greater than Canada, for instance. Yeah, the question is, you'd say, you didn't ask this, but I will answer it. I mean, so what do they get to read? Do they just read commie propaganda? Well, nobody reads commie propaganda.
They have CNN.
They do have CNN.
I was surprised when you told me that. So envision this country. No one envisions televisions with CNN. And I bet they even have them on flat screens.
Yeah, they do. And they have also, what would it be? Say NAN, I guess. CNN in Espanol as well. Yeah. So it's a question, though, of where, and the reason that I'm kind of stumbling here is that to some extent it's like that old parable of the blind man and the elephant. So the one man says, grabs the leg and says, oh, an elephant is like a tree trunk. Another one grabs a trunk and says, like a snake. Another one grabs a tail and says, it's like a rope. And so the ability to spend a week there in one sector and talk to people on an organized tour is, in a way, limited. So I would think that it was necessary to really, if you're interested in this question, and not just be swept along with the political currents, it'd be necessary to do a bit of reading. I mean, I just cranked out, I never even looked at it before this, like 20 pages from Wikipedia online.
History. Now, were you able to explore culturally as well?
This was absolutely incredible. There were two parts, visits we made. One, and the opposite order. We were in this city called Baracoa, which is the second place where Columbus landed in the new, at least to him, the new world, where he began obsessively renaming everything.
What a great point, at least to him.
Yeah. I mean, it was already there. They discovered, you know, the Arawak Indians discovered him. Cuba, by the way, is the only, in Haiti, the only island in the Caribbean or in South America, Latin America, that retains this old name. It's a Taino name that means something like great place. Or, I can read it, where fertile land is abundant.
Yeah.
And it retained the name. Well, Baracoa is this beautiful city. And
how big is it?
Okay. Moving onward. I don't know.
Medium size? What would you say?
Small city.
Small city, okay.
Like the city of Holguin where we
That's
landed.
That's all I need to know. I don't need numbers.
Had 300,000. that's interesting. I'm gonna check that out. I mean, the whole island just is so fascinating. And we did things like, for instance, that were tourism that were probably set up for tourism. Like there was the chocolate trail, the El Sendero de Cocoa.
Cocoa.
But what was interesting to me about it, as I didn't consider myself a tourist there. This was a small factory, although they took you on this path where they showed the growing of the cocoa plants and how it was, how it's processed. And then at the end, candy bars.
Did it taste the same?
Better.
You would buy here?
Better, but you know how those experiences are when you're somewhere else.
You're right in it too, and it's fresh.
As I say, Jillian Jordan, that every Columbus Day I always make the same little speech on the air about how Columbus was greeted by the Arawak people, the Taino-speaking people, and in his diary the first night he wrote, "They will make excellent servants." And by, I don't know, I think within 50 years, all the Taino people, speaking people, were just wiped out. Were just, a total genocide of these folks. But we were introduced to this small community of people who say that they, in fact, are a direct descendant of those people, and they're the remaining people. And there's some argument as to actually there's a genetic connection or not. But they retained a lot of the same beliefs, and, you know, they're not Christians.
Culturally and religious-wise, they're still carrying that tradition on.
Yeah, and so they welcomed us. They roasted a pig.
Really?
They made, they put together, was it 20 or 40? I can't remember, but an enormous number of dishes that were mostly corn and beans and banana and what have you.
You enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. I didn't eat the pig.
Right.
I said, no pig. I don't do pigs. And I know why they put the apple in the mouth, because without the apple in the mouth, this pig did not look very happy.
There's a theory I haven't heard.
the people then danced, and it was a slow couples dance, interestingly, and they had musicians that played. And then at the end, the tour leader gave this thanked people for welcoming us and their hospitality and creating this food. And this was something they don't do. This is not, we weren't like the fourth tour bus there that day. This is very unique, very unusual. And then the woman who was the head of the group just said, you know, how pleased she was to welcome us. And we were all, everybody was almost all in tears. And I can just feel my tear duct.
It sounds so beautiful.
It was. And like I say, I got to get these photos up on my website. But earlier, we also, there was a group that, Santeria, that is...
it's a religion.
It's a religion. It involves several different branches of it, including voodoo, V-U-D-U, as we often see, V-O-O-D-O.
Right.
And we didn't get any food, but they did this on the opposite end. They had all drummers and this absolutely wild dance with these young people that was very,
How amazing was that?
It was amazing, to be sure. And the reason that I bring this up, because it still exists. There's this pocket of indigenous culture that people aren't swept into the modern world of consumption, which we should talk about.
Which does exist in Cuba.
Yeah, it does.
As the cities get larger, you were in some larger
cities. We were in larger cities. Holguín has 300,000 people. They have a La Caverna Club, the Cavern Club, where it plays all Beatles music. They have a band that does all Beatles music in
Spanish.
Really?
Yeah. Did you go?
No. Actually, we were going to go, and then it turned out the band hadn't showed up, and they were playing disco, and it was crowded. Wow. And there is nothing like no smoking there. But
I was going to say, as you got into the contrast between the large cities and the small cities, was it definitely more high-tech, so to speak?
No, there wasn't. There was some cities, like you go to Havana or Santiago de Cuba, that seemed to have that were, I don't know, what would you say? I don't know, more modern. But for
modern,
one of the things, there's still a great amount of transportation by horses. There's horse-drawn vehicles. There's a lot of bicycle cabs that people take all over. I mean, they'd ran out of everything in what was called the special period in the early 1990s. They had no fuel, so that bicycles proliferated, and horse-drawn vehicles made an appearance again. But, you know, they use the horse manure for traditionally, as people always did, and people, organic farmers do in this country for their agriculture. And so you see a lot of that, and you also see all those cars from the 1950s, and there's little Kias, Korean car.
Tiny cars.
Yeah, so leftover, what were those, Ladas? Is that what they're, and it's a Soviet car, I don't know, everybody doesn't have a car. They interestingly, the name of the gasoline stations is, let me see if I can remember, Oro Negro. Black gold.
That's the one. They're all named that.
Everything is owned, with a few little exceptions. Everything is owned by the state, and so like the nightclubs that people in my group went to, they were owned by the state. I mean, it's very bizarre.
That is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how they keep track of it all. For instance, the hotels that we stayed at were named, and I'm the Gaviota Grupo, and that's owned by the army, by the Cuban army.
No kidding.
So go figure.
What about the resort? There are resorts in Cuba.
We stayed mostly at hotels, but there are also what they call all inclusives that are frequented by Canadians and by people from Europe, where, as the name says, are everything you pay one price, everything is else you don't pay for. So you can go up to the bartender and say, "Give me 10 mojitos or piña coladas," and they give them to you. You know, they don't care. These are people that fly over to like Varadero Beach, and they they stay there. There's like maybe 30 or 40 hotels. The only Cubans they ever see are the bartenders and the maids and the people at the desk. And they never experience Cuba at all.
That seems really sad to me. I can't imagine going there and not exploring.
Well, they are interested. If they would go, if the Dominican Republic, if it's $1,500 for a week at an all-inclusive in the Dominican Republic and $1,300 in Cuba at Varadero Beach, they'll go to Varadero Beach.
So they have the same resort experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, less.
Jalene Jordan and I were thinking about could we sum this all up in this one interview, and it looks like that's not the case. So what we're going to do is take a short break and then come back with more. So thank you for joining. Please stay with us. I'm Peter Werby. Jalene Jordan is interviewing me about my recent trip to Cuba. I was there February 2nd to February 9th. Jalene, thank you so much so far.
Thank you. Looking forward to more.
And we'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com. Get your food times two. How old is Luke on the Riff?
Oh, how witty. Get this guy on Hollywood Squares.
Keep your radio on 101 WRIF all weekend long for two firsts from the Foo Fighters. And your free tickets to see the Foo Fighters with special guest Serge Tankian. And against me, February 24th at Joe Louis Arena. One lucky Riff winner will get to meet the Foo Fighters and get a drumhead autographed by the band. Great tickets still available at all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666 or at Ticketmaster.com. The Foo times two weekend. Listen and win.
Hey everyone, this is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, and you're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
I see nothing in your eyes. WFAN.com.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with the big unit. Every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much and welcome back. This is the second segment of an interview that my producer, longtime friend, and sometime co-host, Jalene Jordan, is doing with me about my trip to Cuba. I was there just recently, February 2nd to February 9th, and if you've missed the first part, I don't know what to tell you, because we're going to just have to continue on.
Right.
I was there as a journalist, which is permitted under United States law, and I was there out of personal interest, but more so to bring information about the island itself. And Jalene had just asked me about my stay there, what kind of facilities. One of the hotels, or a number of the hotels we stayed in, were owned by the Cuban government, or the Cuban Army.
Because you were just saying that, well... Yeah. Everything is owned by the government.
Owned by the government, but different sectors are owned by different parts of the government. And this is the kind of thing where I'm thinking, you know, I don't know enough about this, so I'm going to go get a book and read a little more about this. I'm starting with Cuba Wikipedia and then see. I mean, that's not going to be adequate, but I will take a look. So the all-inclusives that they're called is where people come solely for sun and beach. And
this is the separate from the hotels. It's another option.
Yeah. And the idea that people saw, as I said in our last segment, the remnants of Taino-speaking people or voodoo Santeria practitioners or Guantanamo naval base or anything like that is just nothing that particularly appeals to them. We had three guides, Roberto, who I mentioned, Rita, and Julian. All of them were experts on the island and told us a lot about the politics. For instance, Rita, who has lived a good part of her life in the United States, talked about her work. Remember I was saying earlier about dissent. What's the level of dissent? I said... answering my own question, I really don't know. I mean, can you just be a big mouth and get away with it? There's not a tremendous amount of political prisoners. 300, as I said, is 300 too many, but it's not like it's a prison camp with tens of thousands of people that said Fidel sucks. You know.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually surprised that the numbers are that low.
Yeah, well.
I think a lot of people would be.
Yeah. So I think most people are probably concerned with day-to-day life, and that's true in any society. But you ought to have room in a society to be able to make your dissent known. And the slogan of everything inside of the Cuban Revolution, nothing outside, also can work as a self-serving justification for maintaining power. On the other hand, as most people know, during World War I and during World War II, the United States government clamped down very, very hard, not just on people who had done things, but people who they anticipated might do things. For instance, the Japanese who were herded into concentration camps in this country and in Canada. And during the First World War, the suppression of civil liberties was so intense that it made George Bush's America look like he was getting instructions from the ACLU. I mean, you could not criticize the draft, you could not criticize the war, you could not criticize the military, and thousands of people wound up in jail, thousands of people were deported. So countries, when they feel they're under attack, they respond by harsh methods. And do they often use it opportunistically to silence opponents? Sure. I mean, one of the things that World War I did was to stifle trade unions, particularly militant and radical trade unions like the Industrial Workers of the World, that was very prominent at that time, including in our state in Upper Michigan. So you ask about trade unions, do you, in Cuba?
Well, you had mentioned earlier that really if you can't even attempt to unionize Cuba, right?
An independent union. Everybody almost, I don't know. I don't know how many people are in union, but there are any number of trade unions. As in other communist countries, most of which are all gone, the function of trade unions is not like they are in the West, but the function of trade unions is to make sure that the production norms that the state sets are met. Well, that's just a supervisory position, and this is not a trade union. The trade unions, including people from the industrial workers of the world, beginning back in the early part of the 20th century, but also into the 1880s, there were these radical unionists that were called anarcho-syndicalists, without getting into a big explanation about that. Well, they suffered under the Spanish colonial regime all sorts of oppression, you know, death, torture, suppression of their unions, yet they always managed to come back. They always were, the resistance was ongoing. Same thing after the colonial era of the Spanish ended by the Spanish-American War. In the first part of the 20th century, there was then a series of dictators that, again, tortured unionists, suppressed them, destroyed their headquarters, everything imaginable, and they still maintained a presence. But since Castro came in power, there's never been a strike. There's never been an independent union in the manner that they're able to do. So as a trade unionist, as a longtime trade union member, that is a real positive zero. I guess that's called a negative.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at what level do they exist?
Well, I don't. The independent union, zero.
Yeah.
Absolute zero. And in terms of the trade unions, I'm not sure exactly what role that they play in terms of mobilizing production. People in this country, the vast majority of workers in this country don't have union representation of any sort whatsoever.
Right.
And they're supervised and they carry out their tasks either out of goodwill or the fact that there's strict supervision. And a lot of it is goodwill. I mean, there is and particularly among a certain strata, that there is a willingness to build what they see as a socialist society. But there's a lot of things that are eroding it as well, and one of it is, unfortunately, tourism. Because Castro figured out, how are we going to, you know, what capacity do we have for wealth generation and accumulation so we can solve things like the housing problem here, so we can solve the transportation problem. I mean, they have enormous highway system, in some cases 16-lane highways that the Russians built. Well, they figured they could land some planes there as well.
Oh,
and you don't see many cars on it. And you go to a bus stop out in the country, and there can be 100 people there waiting for buses.
I mean, wow.
There's just not enough. And it's embarrassing, I'll tell you, to be on this modern, luxurious tour bus like we have, provided by the Ministry of Tourism, or I'm sure, you know, rented from them by the tour I was on. And then you'll pull up to a rest stop, and there is this battered old bus with no air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's hot there. It's 30 degrees. Hey, I've got that Celsius down. So it's like 90 sometimes. But they see tourism as a way of injecting hundreds of millions of dollars into the economy.
I was going to say, how big is it? And that's another thing. A lot of people wouldn't consider that a tourist attraction.
About 2.5 million. So there's a lot of people. And hundreds. And they must come from all over the world, because I saw some figures, and I actually don't have them at my fingertips, that I think the Canadian tourism was in the hundreds of thousands. One of the things that's occurred, it's created a strata of well-waged workers. Because, for instance, that we loved our three guides and our bus driver, Alejandro, who was just amazing and drove this enormous bus through these teeny streets. And you're going to think, this guy's going to hit the building. And then he never did. Or through this mountain road that went from Santiago de Cuba to... from Guantanamo City to Baracoa, or one of those. But anyway, it was a mountain road that would have scared the pee out of me to drive. So they get paid by the Ministry of Tourism, and also to show our appreciation, we gave them a collective tip. Which was very generous.
Much appreciated, I'm sure.
Which was very generous. Now, a good number of people, I think that the average income, this is going to shock you, is for Cubans, is like $25 a month. You go, whoa, wait a minute. Doesn't that go back to everyone starving to death? Well, when you have most things provided for you, that works okay. I mean, the three things that you really need to live as a human being is food, shelter, and a culture. And the shelter is a little frayed, but it's adequate.
Is it subsidized as well?
I don't know. Well,
I bet there is some.
It's a whole mix. A lot of it is state-owned. A lot of it is traditionally kept in the families of people that didn't leave Cuba. So the whole housing situation is so complex and kind of like a nightmare for Cubans, unless you're happy staying where you are. If you want to move or something like that, you got to do all this trading. It's very nuts. But communist societies typically are very bureaucratic, and that's par for the course. But, oh, yeah, so income. So, that's easy for me as a white North American middle-class male, right? I can say, oh, hey, they got everything they need. They got $25 a month. They got their health care and their food and their shelter.
They got
this wonderful culture. But so, they can't afford iPods or, $100 running shoes and whatnot.
Well, their brains are also a lot less cluttered, I'm sure, than your average American.
They are, but here's what's occurring. I mean, there's nothing so alluring as the capacity to consume. And they are, the Cubans, the average Cuban, the people that aren't making very much money, are aware either through television advertising or movies. I mean, all you got to do is watch an American movie or a European movie, and you see, how are they dressed? Wow, they got Rolex watches.
Excess.
Excess is the key. Now what was being created in Cuba is a strata of people with disposable income. So what do you do with it? I mean, where are you going to spend it? You got to start importing commodities then that people can purchase. So you then have people that at some level, and I don't know whether it's 10% or 90% or somewhere in the middle, of people that are committed to the socialist ideal of equity, of equal work, equal wages. And it's not like it's a class. It's not like these are an owning or even a supervisory class as the way there was in a lot of the Eastern Bloc countries, but rather people that just have more money. And only a certain number of people can enter the tourism. So you have people, I mean, you would think, wow, the person's, quote, just a maid. I mean, believe me, folks, I always say, what would be worse in our city, a lawyer's strike or a garbage man's strike?
We'll take the lawyer's strike.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So a lot of these positions aren't lowly. In fact, there's been cases of doctors and professors who maybe make like $100 a month taking jobs in the tourism industry because they get better paid.
Wow.
So then this is the capitalist model. And some people think that's good. But let's go to democracy. So here you have this pretty rigid political bureaucracy. It's been in there for 50 years, and it's not democratic in the sense that we think of here in the United States, even with all its flaws and all the suppression at different times of civil liberties in this country throughout its history and even some today. We look to other countries like Mexico. A democratic country, although a lot of people, including myself, think the last election was stolen from the left-wing president, much in the way that Bush did in Florida in 2000. But still, a minor glitch along the road. You have a democratic country in Mexico. You have a commie dictatorship in Cuba. Well, if you or I, if we had the same status in this society that we had in Cuba or Mexico, it would probably be okay. Well, let's just say Mexico, because we'd have middle class, we'd have cars, and we go to nightclubs, and we go to rock concerts, and what have you. But the average Mexican, or 50% of Mexicans live on $5 a day or less, and the economy is getting worse and worse. You have the most abominable conditions, to the point where, of course, there's this ruination of the traditional campesino agricultural class because of what NAFTA has done to the Mexicans. So the ones that are the most ambitious, what do? They come to the United States because their traditional way of of earning money has been destroyed, and then they become these despised visitors to the U.S. Yeah. But the ones that aren't, the ones that really accepted the economic defeat that NAFTA has put upon them, they stream into Mexico City and Veracruz and places like that, so that now that Mexico City is probably 26 million people, and probably half of them live in appalling conditions. Well, nobody lives in appalling conditions in Cuba, and there's a lot of safety nets. There's a lot, nobody is dropping below a certain level. So if you're a woman and have a family, or just yourself, or whatever the combination of your family is, I mean, ultimately, the first thing you want is what kind of what kind of physical material life in terms of the basics are going to be available to you. Well, the commie dictatorship does much better, and I put that in quotes, than the Mexican democracy does, and I put it in quotes. Oh, yeah, and also there's these big shootouts with the narcotraficantes in Mexico, and they're killing police officers and police chiefs. There's assassinations. The country is incredibly corrupt. They have one guy, Senor Slim, S-L-I-M, Senor Slim, who has surpassed, and this is Mexico, has surpassed Bill Gates and total wealth, you and I expect to be able to be political big mouths and say George Bush sucks, without anything happening. We expect to be able to have candidates that are wide ranging, although we don't have that in the United States. There's Tweedledum and Tweedledumber. wind up running,
for sure,
depending on what your politics are. And it's all controlled by big money in this country. So to some extent, what's the difference? I mean, it's like I said, my friend in Holguin said, there's a lot of good things about Cuba and the government sucks. It's a lot like here.
Yeah.
So what does one hope for? People say, they can't wait till Castro dies. And
when nothing will change.
Well, they say then everything will change. The communist dictatorship will...
Who are they?
A lot of people.
Okay, that's what I was going to say, because you don't believe that, do you?
I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, Castro, for all practical purposes, has been removed by illness from the ruling apparatus. So,
and his brother is running.
And his brother.
The show,
so,
right?
But it's a gerontocracy. It's the rule of the aged. And with all due respect to our elders, if it's just kept there, I mean, that increases the rigidity. If you ask a Cuban what's going to happen when Fidel dies, they'll usually say, quien sabe, who knows? If you ask people that are in the party, they'll say, the mechanism of the Cuban government, socialism, blah, blah, it's all. So I don't know. But certainly the Cuban, the Miami Cubans are hoping that that the government will collapse and that things will what? I'm not even sure. I mean, I've talked to Miami Cubans that say, before Castro, Cuba was this wonderful place where everybody was happy and, kind of like that. It was a paradise. Well, that wasn't the case at all. They had this line of dictatorships. It's not like Castro, altered took this democratic government and transformed it into this dictatorship. There was a dictatorship, Batista, who ran a torture state, who had thousands and thousands of political prisoners, who mowed down demonstrators, there was this, the people lived in abject poverty, the country was sold out.
It sounds a lot worse then.
Well, it was. It sold out to the mob, had sold out to the mob. It was, a whorehouse and a gambling den for Americans. And sure, it was great for Ernest Hemingway to go to La Florita bar and drink and what have you. But the Cuban people were really in terrible shape.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, I spent some time in Miami. I lived in Miami. And it seemed like at least two or three times a week there were the people who had escaped from Cuba and were, on whatever kind of float or whatever it took for them to get here. And how would you describe those people? Are, as you said, the Mexicans that come to the United States, are they the more ambitious? Why do they want to leave? Because they see on television what they see about the United States?
Now, I think it's kind of the same thing, yeah. I mean, particularly since Cubans get a better deal. They can just come here and they call wet foot, dry foot. You know that? That if you...
Yes, if you have one foot...
If you touch land, you get to stay in the U.S. It's the only immigrant group that's allowed to do that. So, you know, it's like escape from communism. And I guess, you know, the Mexicans are escape from capitalism, right?
Yeah,
capitalism gone bad. Certainly, I mean, to try to describe all of this in Cuban history, that a lot of people were simply nationalists who were offended by how badly Cuba was run under this series of dictatorships, ending it with Batista's, and expected to have a democratic government. Instead, that Castro and initiated a harsh regimen and regime, and began nationalizing property. And the people, the middle class, and certainly the upper class, suddenly didn't have the privilege that they had. I mean, it's like the opposition to Chavez now. The people that that are now in the forefront of the opposition to Chavez never uttered a peep when everything was run just for the benefit of the upper middle class and the wealthy. Suddenly they're all about democracy and all of this. And it's not to say that both Castro and Chavez aren't due criticisms, and that there shouldn't be changes that more democratize Cuba. I mean, Venezuela is democratic. The Venezuelans just keep electing somebody that Bush doesn't like. But so, I mean, in a sense, what do I hope for there? Do I hope that the whole system is going to be come unraveled and it'll wind up what? Do you know what it'll wind up like? It'll wind up like Jamaica.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, whereas you have these great beachy parts, and then you have cities like Kingston where are too dangerous even to go.
Absolutely. I've been all over Jamaica, and I've seen it firsthand, the poverty, and it's horrible.
In Cuba, Cuba's one of the safest countries in Latin America. I mean, overall, it's certainly safer than the United States.
Because crime is lower?
Crime is very, very low. I was surprised. At one point, we were advised not to go out at night in this one town of Santiago de Cuba, which I'd never heard that. People say, and people tend to, you know, people can exaggerate, that's for sure. But I was told that a woman could walk through deserted neighborhoods in downtown Havana with her purse open at midnight, and nothing would happen.
Well, and I can't say that for Detroit.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know that I can say that for Havana. That's just what I've heard. I know that a friend of mine and I were walking in Havana. They have and this was on a first trip. We were walking to John Lennon Park. And John Lennon Park, it's a wonderful park. That's actually
on my picture of the statue.
Yeah, my website now. Peter Werby. Werbe, peterwerby.com. You can go down on the right side of it, where they have a life-size statue of John Lennon sitting on a park bench. And then the words to Imagine in bronze on the ground.
Yeah.
So all of us, everybody, sits there and gets their photograph taken next to John Lennon.
Of course you do.
And then you can go on to V.I. Lennon, which is a park named after the Russian dictator, which I found thoroughly offensive. And someone said we ought to go a Lennon to Lennon tour. And I said, you know, I'm going to stick with John and Imagine, not you know, go see some guy that that ushered in something, you know, pretty badly.
Yeah. So at the beginning of this interview, I came out and said what people said to me, Peter, about, first of all, I said, Peter's in Cuba. First they said, is he crazy? And then, of course, how you can travel, which we've explained. But really what I've heard, which you've told me many times, and I just find fascinating, that things really aren't so grim in Cuba compared to a lot of countries around the world, and that really it is a lot of the stereotypes that people have about the country that you seem to have squashed in this interview.
Well, as I've said on the show and we've said on the shows that we do, that you have to be careful of the information that is received. I mean, to some extent, all information is received, and spending a week in Cuba doesn't mean I understand the country. And there are so many things that just left me scratching my head. I mean, it was wonderful. Wonderful experience, and to be able to learn all this about Cuba, and to some extent, I've only scratched the surface. Some of this I could have said without ever having gone there, but I think that, as you said, reversing the stereotypes, but understanding that most governments that have ever existed, and all the ones that exist today, are problematic. They got problems. The governments generally do bad things. And if we're lucky, the people get some rewards and benefits. In this country, a lot of it is really skewed towards class and race and what have you. And for a country that's trying to eliminate a lot of that, that's very positive. Do I think they're going to be successful? I'm pretty pessimistic about the world in general. I mean, having been to Venezuela and seeing the results of another 50 years of looting of the country's wealth, and that only winds up in the hands of wealthy Venezuelans and foreign corporations, and seeing Chavez trying to spread a little of that and still seeing the most awful poverty conditions that were far worse than Cuba. And typical of much of Latin America, it's depressing. I mean, we have a situation now where about 500, mostly men, almost all men, control, you know, trillions of dollars of wealth. And that's ultimately what it's all about. I mean, where's the wealth of the world? I mean, these men controlling the trillions, if they were going to say, okay, we decided to get kind of generous and we're going to give up, I don't know, I would say maybe not even that much, $500 trillion. All these questions would be done with, because mostly in the world, people are scrambling about what it comes down to, wealth, and you know, whether it's money or resources or what have you. And that old adage about, the adage was that I was thinking of was the love of money is the root of all evil. But actually, money is the root of all evil. And there's as far as I'm concerned, oh, I'm not even talking about Cuba. I'm just philosophizing now. But
I have to agree with you.
There's a communal spirit that's inherent in the species. There's a sociobiology of sharing and love for one another. I mean, oftentimes in the people that we moved out of this, our area, the native people that live in Michigan here, mm-hmm. They had that. And they often weren't real big towards other folks. You know, they were like internally really cohesive and loving and tolerant and collective and communal and all that. But other folks they weren't big on. Well, we live in too big a world now to keep maintaining the such concentration of wealth and to the point where, you know, people are slaughtered, wars are fought. I don't know what's going to happen to the people of Cuba. That's, can I ask you that? I mean, because if you ask me, I would say I don't know.
I'd say there's no change after Fidel Castro, but we'll see.
Well, okay. Let's say. Let me look at our clock here. I know this is pretty unprofessional. All right, we got a minute or so. We can end on that. The government structure could remain the same, but as it enters a world of consumerism, I think that's going to take down the ideals.
Okay.
And that's pretty discouraging. And I hope I'm wrong. And in terms of change, every move towards democracy in Cuba, I'll support. Of course, I would like to start with the country that I live in, called the United States, which I would like to support every move towards democracy, because they certainly don't have an ideal democracy here. So before we start, as Americans, start criticizing Cuba, I don't mean to say we can't criticize it, but in terms of our actions or what we support, we need to focus on our land here. When things occur that make Cuba more democratic and still, but that aren't about destroying it, I'm all for it. The history of the United States towards Cuba is really disgraceful since it's for the last 100 and so years. And the embargo should be left. Everyone should have the right to freedom of travel. And I don't know whether that's ever going to end or not. I could imagine a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president after the next election, with Republicans introducing a bill to repeal the Embargo Act, which the Republicans have done because they want markets. They want the Republicans have all keep introducing bills that would stop all this insanity. In the meantime, if you can't do it and you have the wherewithal, which of course is a big factor, and there are things that have to do, for instance, with your profession or trade or what have you, there are conferences and things like that, and people can go there and learn about it firsthand.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for filling us in on your trip to Cuba. It was very interesting, and I think a lot of us have a whole new view of the country because of your interview.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you, Jalene Jordan. I appreciate you brought out some good thoughts in me. And if people want to email me with questions or comments or criticisms, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Thank you very much.
And that's our interview. Well, that was recorded a few days ago. Jalene Jordan is here with me in the studio. And if you'd like to call and make any comments about what you've heard over the last hour, my trip to Cuba, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, or as I just said on the recording, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll get you to me by email. I wanted to correct two aspects of my terrible Spanish. One was the bar in Havana where Ernest Hemingway used to hang out. It's La Floridita. I don't know what the hell I said, but it was some, yeah. And also, it's cacao, which is the charcoal.
Not, what did we say? Cocoa.
That something. Was my fault.
But it's cacao. It did sound wrong when I heard it. It just didn't click. But
so that's correct. And also, I was just looking online. You can do that, too. Crime in Cuba. Apparently, there's more than I was saying. Remember I said that it was said that a woman could walk down a street in Havana at midnight with a purse open. Well, apparently, as tourism increases and there starts to be the stratification of income, crime actually has increased. Yeah, a lot of pickpocketing, stuff like that.
Okay, so zip the purse.
Okay, so remind me who we have as our first caller.
We have Darius from Detroit.
Okay, I got to push the... Oh, what did I just do? I just hit something. There, he's back. All right, Darius from Detroit. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being our first caller. Thanks for sitting through the long interview.
No problem, Peter. Thank you. I have comments about Cuba. I was there 5 times in Cuba. I spent... several times I was there for 2-3 months at a time.
How were you able to do that?
I just got a flight from Toronto.
Yeah.
And you could cross the border and go, you can get a flight from Toronto just online or you call. Call in.
Well, it sounds like I'm catching a slight accent. Are you of Latin ancestry?
No, I'm Polish.
Polish, okay. Well, it shows you what the hell I can tell.
I was ambitious enough to learn Spanish because I took the first time I went to Latin country was Spain, and then Spain was kind of too far. So, I started searching around. I wandered around. I don't want to, just be, sit here in Detroit. And anyways, about Cuba, about people being, like you said, happy. And you don't see any sign of poverty, upon faces. I think it has to do a lot with what they watch on TV, about the media thing. There's only, like you said, the CNN in Spanish is available. The only cables. I was not in an all-inclusive resort like most of the people are. I was always looking on the internet. I looked at Casa Particular,
right,
where people pay about $200 every month to be able to rent out to foreigners, a room or 2 rooms or however big apartment they have available.
Yeah, let me just make clear, Darius, what you're saying in these Casa Particular, you pay to the government a tax, and then you can rent out your rooms.
Well, the owner pays a tax.
Right.
No matter, if he has it rented out or not, it's anywhere between, in Havana it's around $200, but in a city like Camagüey, where I spend most of my time, they only pay about $100 to $150.
Okay. So overall, your impression was a positive one.
Oh, of course. It's about the people. It's nothing else. It's just the people. And it's a wonderful country, and I have wonderful memories. It's only now I haven't been there in 3 years, but maybe, if the dollar, the dollar rate goes up, I'll be able to go back there again and see all my friends.
Well, that's good. That's an interesting experience. Somebody from your background and then winding up in Cuba. Well, thank you, Darius. Let me get some more calls. 313-298 WRIF, calls about Cuba, but also, as usual, we're open line till 1 a.m., so
yeah.
You can...
And there are a lot of things that happened in the last week, including, I bet, a few people out there who would like to talk about GM.
Yeah, I want to get to that in about a minute.
Yeah.
But Corey is calling us from Shelby Township. You may remember Corey. He was the Santeria priest, am I right,
oh,
Corey?
Right.
You're on the air. Are you with us, Corey?
Yes, I am. How
yeah.
are you doing?
Yeah, so you you went on a religious license that the United States Department of State granted to you, so you could make a religious visit to Cuba, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So what was your impression of my interview?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was really interesting. You got a perspective that I never got a chance to see. I mean, you were in a completely different environment, which I thought was really interesting to hear about,
mm-hmm.
so... but I did have one question for you. You said you went through Toronto?
Sure, yes.
Okay, so did you convert your American dollars to Canadian, then from Canadian to Cuban dollars?
To Cuban convertible peso, which is used by the tourist. Yeah, I'm sure I got screwed so badly. Yeah, I had to change to the Canadian dollar to the Cuban convertible peso, and then on
right.
the way back, I had to change it all back again. So I couldn't even begin to estimate how much I lost.
Okay, because I was wondering how much they charged you or how much they hit you with once you converted to the convertible peso.
I can't, that's interesting. I can't remember. I wonder if any of my travel mates are listening. Come on, if you are, spend a couple bucks or a buck and call 313-298-WRIF if you remember the conversion rate. But I think it was, oh, I don't know, somewhere 75, 80 cents on the dollar.
Oh, wow, okay. The reason why I asked is when I went to Cuba, I flew down to Miami International and from Miami International straight to Havana.
Right.
And for the conversion rate, it was we took a 20% hit on the U.S. dollar to the Cuban convertible. But I had a friend who lived in Toronto who went maybe 2 or 3 months after I did, and from what she had told me, they did a 1-to-1 ratio on their conversions from the Canadian dollar to the U.S. dollar.
Hmm. Well,
so I was wondering if it was because of your U.S. citizenship, looking at your passport and your visa and everything, if they hit you with the same penalty or
oh,
not.
No. They didn't. When I was converting, they didn't know where they didn't ask me for my passport at that time. We flew into Holguin. We never even were near Havana.
Okay, I wasn't sure, so I was curious about that.
Okay, thank you, Corey.
All right, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, thanks for calling. Well, yes, Jalene Jordan just mentioned what was going on at GM. GM reported a $722 million fourth quarter loss last Tuesday. And now they're offering buyouts to about 74,000 unionized employees, in which they called their turnaround. They want to keep its turnaround from stalling. And you wonder, what's going on here? They're going to offer workers at General Motors up to 140,000, but most people, I think, are probably going to get around 50,000. But here in the last line in this article from the New York Times, way down at the end, people usually don't get to it, says the Detroit automakers, and that includes all of the Chrysler and Ford as well, are each hoping to persuade more workers to leave so they can replace some with new hires earning half as much money.
I know, and I saw a guy on the news who had been working there forever. I mean, I can't remember how many years, but it was 30 or something like that. And he said, you know what, I would like to take this buyout and let someone new come in, but I can't afford it. I've got to stay here.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't amount to much when you really get down to it. This is permitted by this two-tier wage provision in the four-year contracts that the UAW signed with the GM, Ford, and Chrysler. And the critics of the settlement said, you're going to wind up cutting your union wage force and also with the amount of pay that they're going to. I mean, think about sometimes when people talk about unions, they say, yeah, my grandfather was in the UAW, my father was in the UAW, but they're not really necessary anymore. Well, your grandfather and your father, and maybe you even, fought for generations to get a decent standard of living, decent wages, decent benefits, decent pensions, and in one fell swoop, you're going back to the 1930s.
Yeah.
I mean, this is astounding what is going on here. And you think about it, remember I've used this before, there used to be a saying, I think it might even become like 100 years ago when you would say some criticism and somebody, rather than answer you, would say, well, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich? And I would say to all these suits at GM and Ford and Chrysler, if you're so rich, why aren't you smart?
I love that.
Why can't you keep a workforce waged at what generations of people have fought for? So we're back, 100 years ago. This is really terrible. This is really awful.
Yeah, and I wonder what, I know there are many, many, many men and women out there listening right now who are trying to make their own decision about this.
Yeah.
Where their future lies. It's horrifying. It's terrifying for these people. I feel horrible.
Indeed, and we may have read this last week. Many believe U.S. already in recession. What do you think? Yeah. Could the country be in recession? This article asks. The empty homes and for sale signs clutter neighborhoods. Your job, you lost your job or know someone who has, your paycheck and nest egg are taking a hit. Why is this happening? Why is this happening in the richest country in the world, in which the stock market is still fairly astronomical? Sure, it's been...
Wait, something about that. How many trillions are we spending in Iraq?
Yeah. Well, how about this?
Maybe it has something to do with that.
Yeah. Well, Robert Reich, who is this economist, and I think he's at the University of California. Where is this guy? University of California, Berkeley. And he's written Super Capitalism. And he's got this this critique of what's going on. He says, we're sliding into recession or worse. I don't like the sound of that. We're sliding into recession or worse, and Washington is turning to the normal remedies for economic downturns. But the normal remedies, and he's talking about these rebates. He says they're not likely to work this time because this isn't a normal downturn. The problem lies deeper, he says. It is a culmination of three decades during which American consumers have spent beyond their means. The era is now coming to an end. Consumers have run out of ways to keep the spending binge going. Well, here, you see whose fault it is. It's ours. It's ours. It's not these... bosses who can't run an auto company. It's not a country that now is spending $1 trillion a year in the worst way imaginable in terms of making the economy run, that is, on this war budget. It's us. It's because you went along with what you saw on TV. You had all these things dangled in front of you, were told aren't luxuries, but in fact are necessities. How can you live without an iPod or all the other junk and crap and clothing and everything else? I mean, from time to time, Jolene and I, we read these ads for...
From the New York Times.
Yeah, from $1,000 purses and $400 sweaters.
$15,000 purses.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But in this...
Crazy.
Yeah, I forgot to mark this up, actually. But Robert Reich, in this article, he talks about things like a larger earned income tax credit. I'm saying I don't remember exactly what all of his solutions are, because none of those are going to work either. And no one is talking about the military-industrial complex and the fact that costs us $1 trillion a year. And if we could have massive tax cuts for the middle class and the working class, and tax raises for the ultra-wealthy who have been the beneficiary of a constant, now I say constant, through all the administrations for the last 30 years of policies that affect them. And I'm not talking about corporations here. I'm talking about money that's been granted to the ultra-rich that are ultimately responsible for all of this, because corporations would perhaps, in fact, expand their productive capacity, hire more workers and all that. The rich just were involved in this binge of investing that up till now has brought them billions and billions and billions more.
Right.
But also it has created this house of cards that's beginning to collapse.
Well, and they stop at $200,000. Isn't that right?
What's that?
In paying taxes?
Oh, in the payroll tax.
Yeah.
I think it's just $100,000.
Right.
I mean, that would be one way. People should pay payroll taxes to the totality of their income.
And the fact that they don't, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
It's real backward.
And there's all these articles that appear in the New York Times that you'll never see, like in the Detroit News or Free Press or here on the news. The credit crisis painting Wall Street. That's what they're concerned about, not you and me, is reaching out across the nation, afflicting municipalities, hospitals, and cultural touchstones like the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In recent days, another large but obscure corner of the financial world has come under acute stress. Alarmed by the running turmoil in the debt markets, investors have refused to buy certain securities that not long ago many regarded as equivalent to cash. So I don't even begin to tell you this because it is so, I don't even understand it at all. But they have auctions of securities. They have, what else here?
Yeah, I was reading about these auction rate securities and
credit default swaps.
Yeah.
We have this economy that has been created in such a manner that rather than being simple, where people work, this is the capitalist model now we're talking about, folks, where people work for a living and they get paid and then they spend, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they save.
And usually overspend.
Well, as it would be, the model should be not
right,
all
right,
that.
Right.
And then the investor or the, let's say the entrepreneur, he or she has a business, has a certain return on investment, tries to moderate the wages and other costs of doing business. But instead, you have these totally bizarre, complex, absolutely ununderstandable, opaque institutions that nobody even knows about. I never knew about any of this until I've just been reading recently. And if you called upon me really to explain it, I sort of have a resistance to understanding it. It's like we shouldn't live in a world like this where they have the wealthy control these complex financial instruments and institutions to the point where the average person has not only no idea of what's going on, has no capacity to control it at all.
Yeah.
So we are...
Let alone understand it for many people.
Yeah. So we are under... we talk about democracy. We're talking about democracy in Cuba. There's no economic democracy here. It is a total totalitarian dictatorship, and the average person has to accept what is doled out to us.
And we could throw in a little theocracy.
Yeah,
a couple of phone calls, I see.
313-298-WRIF. Here's Samantha in Redford. Hi, Samantha. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hey, guys. So you guys are talking about the buyouts and everything and how the money really doesn't go that far. And it honestly doesn't. My grandpa worked at Ford for 32 years, and he took the buyout. He was being paid $12 an hour to collect trash and everything. He took the buyout. Now him and my grandmother are in serious debt.
Yeah, wow.
And they're about to lose their house.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, well, the economy's just so bad, and, like, he can't find a job now, and, like, he doesn't understand why. It's like you had a 12-hour job.
You know what, Peter, I was thinking about this, and I don't know if you will agree, the caller, is we may be going back to a time when the extended family is back together, where families are living all together because of survival.
Yeah, increasingly that's the case.
Yeah.
People have way extended in terms of mortgages. They lose their homes. Detroit now leads the nation in foreclosure rates.
And we're number one.
Number one. Oh, yeah. We're always saying, where are we number one? Yeah.
And everything rotten.
Yeah, yeah.
And that includes the country.
Well, as I was saying, Samantha, that the generations fought to have a decent wage standards with unions as always leading the way. They always talk about unions, the people that invented the weekend. Because left to the tender mercies, of course, of the employers, they'd have us working 12 hours a day in the worst unsafe conditions. And there was an understanding that a lot of these jobs, if you committed yourself to them, they were for life. They had a phrase in Japan called the Iron Rice Bowl, is that when you signed on to one of the Japanese companies, you had the right to be there for life. And there was another old saying from like 100 years ago, the world doesn't owe you a living. Why doesn't it? Why doesn't it? The ultra-wealthy thinks that the world owes them a living, and they manipulate the world to ensure that this will be the case. But for the peons, the peasants, the workers, it's just too bad. We're just an element of production. If they can get us cheaper, fine. If they don't need us anymore, adios, MF.
Yeah, right.
Well, gee, should I say that?
It's okay.
It's okay. It's just an abbreviation.
Yeah.
That's
Melon farmer. That's another way of saying it.
I got it. I just figured it out.
Okay.
Here's Andre in Livonia. Hi, Andre. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing? And Jolene, how you doing?
We're both doing
Hi, great.
Good. I shouldn't speak
Peter,
for
her. I've been listening to you since high school days, and it's been quite a long time.
You're now ready for retirement.
yeah, I'm a Teamster Local 337, and I was just curious about your opinion on unions, and do you really think that they'll be around in the near future, or do you see them falling apart? I work for Kroger's Warehouse, where I talked to you last week. We were losing our jobs and stuff.
Yeah, well, the unions haven't been able to defend their members to the extent you would think. But when you're in a period of economic contraction, unions become a lot weaker. On the other hand, this is the point where unions not only have to defend the rights and the standards of their workers, but have to be the advocates, as they are politically, for the rights and the standards of the entire group of people in our society that work, which means the middle class and white collar and blue collar and all of that. And historically, unions have done that, because unions, even in the heyday of unions, say like in the 1950s, I don't think unions ever represented more than a third of the total working class. And yet they had enormous power. Well, now we're down to about 6% or something like that. Yet, if you look at what unions do in Lansing, here in our state, in Washington, they're always lobbying, trying to get candidates elected, all which would ensure a standard of living that we thought we had won from the for the last 100 years, but suddenly we're going south. And,
right.
Yeah. So...
So what's your opinion? What do you think as far as, do you think there's a possibility that our unions will survive all this? I mean, it's looking pretty grim.
Well, it's looking grim. I'll tell you, I have a wonderful union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and things are looking kind of grim for us. We're not gaining members. We're losing members. And on the other hand, there's some bright spots. And actually, union membership in Michigan actually increased some this year, with about 40,000 home care workers being unionized. And okay, some of the unions have decided, well, wait a minute, we're going to go away. We're going to be history unless we start devoting a large amount of money to organizing. So the things like the SEIU and some of these other unions have...
How about that nurses union, those radical women out in California? They're making things happen out there.
The California Nurses Union. And you see, like, for instance, at the Detroit Medical Center, nurses are trying to organize there. And you would here in the city of Detroit, where many ways modern labor was almost invented, you've got the Detroit Medical Center acting like their Ford Motor Company in 1938.
Right, right. Yeah. UPS too is also they're pulling out of our pension plan too, which is kind of scary because that's less members for us.
Sure. Well, it's a scary period, and I don't know. I'm not really sure what is going to happen. I mean, in a period of economic contraction, you'll get people that are going to predict the most dire situation imaginable. So we're going to have a world depression. The United States dollar is going to lose 90% of its value. We've heard all that. In the period when capital is expanding and it's a period of prosperity, then you have people saying Dow 40,000, you know, it's going to go up to that kind of stratospheric level. So I don't know.
I just wanted your opinion, though, but thank you very much.
Okay, Andre, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
I guess I was trying to say, in maybe too many words, is I don't know.
Sorry, Peter.
Yeah.
Well, you're honest.
Yeah.
And that's I guess that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, what about all those people there was a book called, like, Dow 40,000. I mean, what does that guy think? I mean, it went up to what, a little over 14,000.
You know what he's probably saying right now?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, he's writing another book. Yeah, how everything's going to go to hell. All right. We got some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Archie in Madison Heights. Archie, hi. It's Peter and Jelena on WRIF. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air. Did I do anything wrong?
Archie should be there.
Archie, you with me, buddy?
There you are.
What's going on?
What?
Can you hear me?
kind of.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go, Archie.
What's going on, Peter? How you doing?
Well.
Yeah. Well, anyways, God bless George Bush. I'm out.
God bless George Bush. I'm out.
You are. Man.
You are, man. You're way out.
You're off the hook, dude.
Yeah, you're out on that planet Pluto that's no longer a planet.
Yeah, more. It's actually, I think he's out of, what's that planet? Uranus.
Oh, yeah, it's Uranus for sure. Yeah, you got it. Sorry. You're right, Peter.
Right.
You know, and I drive around and still see people with these W stickers, and I think, are you freaking kidding me? I had to clean it up because I
rolled up to him and said, hey, somebody put a George Bush sticker on the back of your car.
You better get that off. And the other one that has resurfaced is the man plus woman equals marriage one, that red one.
Really? I never saw
nothing, that. Nothing burns me up more than that one. And you know what? I usually ignore people when I drive because I don't, you know, you never know what you're getting into. But that one, I always give them what I call the stink eye.
Do you think they actually realize?
And I shake my head.
Yeah?
Oh, they know. They have to know. Bigots.
Yeah,
sorry.
Well, where was I just thinking about
sorry.
This? Oh, yeah. I'm going to do an interview. With, what's the name of this book? Because I don't have it set up yet. But the publicist says it's not about gay marriage, but it's about marriage itself and what constitutes marriage and what have you. And I was thinking back to these people that, you know, that have these negative opinions about gay marriage, about man and man or woman and woman.
Yeah.
Legally marrying and saying, yeah, hello, we're full human beings. We have the full rights. When I first came out, I was saying, what if there would have been a constitutional amendment in Michigan? Michigan really disgraced itself by putting that in the Constitution. What if they would have said races couldn't marry or Jews couldn't marry or something like that? That's what's equivalent to.
I agree.
And plus, though, when you see all of this, when you see gay couples, when suddenly there's a place where they can marry, here are these happy, joyous couples, just like at any union.
And their families are happy and joyous.
And
mostly.
If they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you see the people that support marriage, and they're just filled with hate and
anger. Yeah. Get your own island. Burn it out.
Now, let's see. I'm not reading this through, but Steve sent this in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We reported this a long time ago, at 11 o'clock here. Tom Scholz of the rock band Boston issued this statement when he heard that Mike Huckabee's campaign is using his song More Than a Feeling at campaign rallies. Yeah, this is the statement that we said. Boston has never endorsed a political candidate. Let me see.
And it certainly won't be Mike Huckabee, basically, is what he was saying.
It would be like Obama using a right-wing Hank Williams Jr. song at his rallies. Is Hank Williams...
I don't know.
It says, how about Williams, if the South would have won, we'd have had it made.
Oh, well.
Well, he's right-wing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that one, that particular little bit is definitely...
That's dumb old Southern white people. They realize it without realizing that slavery benefited not them. In fact, it drove down the cost of their labor, and rather it just benefited the owners.
Hey, ready? Duh.
Duh. Yeah. How dumb can you get?
Yeah. Hey, we do have some phone calls, just so you know.
Sorry.
And only about, 10, 15 minutes left of the show.
Okay, so we'll get those.
Got to keep you on track.
Quickly. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Tell me quick, Maurice.
I'm making a new man law. Anybody that cheats on a significant other is a call of Kwame.
Wait, can you start over?
I get a new phone.
Anybody that cheats on a significant other is now called a Kwame.
If you cheat on your significant other, you're now called a Kwame.
Oh, jeez.
You know, that goes...
at least Bill Slick Willie's off the hook now, at least in Detroit.
That's kind of unusual. No man has ever cheated on his significant other before. This is quite a shock.
What are you doing tonight? Well, I think I'm going to go pull a Kwame.
Yeah. He's in plenty of trouble.
Maurice, you are something else.
Here's Bob in Ortonville. Bob, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I've been listening to the show now for a few, you know, probably 6 months.
Uh-huh.
I'm studying education, and I just wondered if you had any opinions or information about No Child Left Behind Act.
Well, most teachers that I know don't like it at all. And the standardized test, it's funny. We need a...
Well, it's a lie. The statement in
itself.
Well,
yeah.
It's bogus.
Well, for one thing, that the fact that schools that need it the most are funded the least is evidence that there's lots of children left behind. And there's deteriorating school systems all over the country. It's not just inner cities. It's rural. It's suburban. And it goes back to the same old thing. We have two choices here. We can either have a military-industrial complex, which spends $1 trillion a year down this rat hole of spending for war and preparation for war. That's, I don't know, what's the figures? 10 times, 20 times the combined total that all the other countries in the world spend. Or we can devote ourselves to dealing with what is happening in our country. And one of the things that is happening that is really bad, which is another thing that makes sure that we are not number one, is we have an educational system that is not well funded. So we can either fund Lockheed and Raytheon and companies like that, or we can fund our school system. So that's what I got to say. All right, Bob, thank you very much. Making our program international. Here's Matt from Windsor. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. How's it going?
Going well.
I have a question for you. You were talking about George Bush, right?
Well, yeah. we talk about him a lot, yeah.
We say here in Detroit, we dog him.
I have to say, you guys are American, and you guys have such a strong patriotism, right? Well, it seems like in the recent wake of economic struggle that everyone is kind of blaming the government, you know? And my question is, and after September 11th, there's this thing called United We Stand, Divided We Fall. It just seems that everyone...
old Sonny and Cher song.
That not what it is?
He sang it, yeah. Oh. They sang it at the end of every show.
I guess I have to say I never saw it. Never. Anyway, United
Maybe
We Stand.
Was babe,
thing.
I got you, babe.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, you're right. He says. He said, Matt, you said United We Stand thing. The United We Stand thing was a bumper sticker, and some of them are even still on cars and trucks.
Yeah, along with those.
I don't know what. I don't know exactly.
Are you saying that you feel that we are not supporting the United States?
I mean, but let me just say one thing. That Bush assured we would not stand united by his divisive policies.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Well,
for
I'm
sure.
saying, like, it just seems like the country is very divided as far as, like, having faith in their beliefs and in their system, you know? And it just seems like they're not really going to survive if they don't come together, you know what I mean? Like, there needs to be some sort of synergy.
Well, I agree, and that's what some people think Barack Obama is about. I think it's a little overblown.
But historically, that's what this country has, it's always been this way. Things are so horrible right now because of the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fact that our civil liberties are being tromped on in the name of terrorism. You know, it just, we could go on and on and on, and none of it's good.
Well, let me say this. Let's make an assumption, which neither Jalene nor I do, that George Bush, under the peculiar American system, won the election of 2000. I mean, we think he cheated, that votes were suppressed. In fact, same thing in 2004. I think George Bush lost both elections. We know he lost the popular vote in 2000. Mm-hmm. And he said he wanted to be a uniter. So he had a far right-wing agenda. He lost the popular vote, but through the quirk of the electoral system, which is the official explanation, he was able to become the president. So rather than, as they say, reaching across the aisle, he immediately began this far right-wing, pro-corporate, pro-war agenda that was totally out of sync with the majority of people who have voted in that election. And he guaranteed what came after. And his economic policies guaranteed that we are now in this, we are a debtor nation, and that, oh yeah, I got one to
and
say.
And he's completely divided our country instead of united our country. Completely divided our country.
And the world.
And the world.
Thank
Absolutely,
you very much.
Peter.
You may remember, where the hell is that? You may remember somebody called in and said that I was totally off the wall.
Which time?
Yeah, right.
You get that a lot.
Yeah, which time? Oh, yeah. That I was wrong when I had said that the Saudis were financing the U.S. government.
Right.
And you know, I don't have all the facts at my fingertips, and I don't have...
Like four, during the show, essentially.
Four producers, and sometimes I make mistakes, and that's why you folks are so good, and when I make a mistake, you say, here it is. So someone said, no, the Saudis were not financing the U.S. at all. So I actually looked it up online, and in this article saying the Saudi public leery of Bush, that he's deeply unpopular among ordinary Saudis. A recent poll found 12% here view Bush positively. Remember, he went to Saudi Arabia in January, and rather than saying, hey, we need cheaper gas, he was telling the Saudis, do not pump more oil because we want the price of oil to remain high, both because of all of his oil buddies like ExxonMobil that have, again, record profits, but also because then that meant that more money would be going from us to the Saudis, and the Saudis, in return, could loan the United States more money. So caller columns is not that absolutely crazy. And I thought, gee, maybe I really blew it. Well, in the same article, kind of in the back, it says the United States became the kingdom's biggest trading partner. This is sort of a little history. The Saudis became the biggest buyers of U.S. weapons, $39 billion worth in the 1990s. They have also been major U.S. creditors, buying billions in treasury bonds and enthusiastic investors in U.S. business. So they buy billions and billions of treasury bonds, which means they are financing George Bush's mistakes.
Right. We're right.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's go on. Here's Brian and Clyde. Clyde is in Michigan, Brian?
That's in Port Huron area.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Welcome. Well,
when you don't know where a city is, it's always in the Port Huron area.
That's it.
Go ahead, man. Okay. What's up?
I just wanted to make a comment about the unions. I'm a journeyman machinist at Chrysler, and I've been working there for 9 years. And when I hired into Chrysler, we used to build all of our own tooling in this country. And because of NAFTA, now everything is bought in Asia, and we just fix and repair, and it's just altogether different than it was. And I don't think people understand that. It's totally changed.
Well, you know, Brian, we hear about deindustrialization, and it's become one of those phrases, sort of like the military-industrial complex. But what you're saying is very important. We have to give content to that. And about all we produce now in any important manner is weaponry. So we're supplying the world endlessly with weapons so people can kill one another all across the world. And NAFTA did it. And it was the Republicans, essentially, who put that in. And for some reason, could be because of corporate funding, Bill Clinton signed it.
Yep.
Now, the whole election, as far as I'm concerned, is skewed way towards the center. And if we would have had a correct representation of the aspirations of the American people, on the right, we would have had Ron Paul, and on the left, we would have had Dennis Kucinich. But neither of them, well, Dennis Kucinich has dropped out. Ron Paul, for some reason, is still in.
Amazing.
Yeah. And when he says repeal NAFTA, Dennis Kucinich says repeal NAFTA. Does Hillary Clinton? No. Barack Obama? Barack Obama at least talks about some problems with it. But ain't no way in the world that unless there's a mass movement, and that's the problem with people organizing around a single candidate. I mean, I'm sure it'll turn out to be Barack Obama will be the lesser of the two evils, but it would be good if we had a mass-based movement that, like in the 1960s, that forced a president to sign legislation that without that mass movement never would have. And that includes, by the way, both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. If you think about Richard Nixon signing all this environmental legislation, but then going back to a Southern president who got on television and said, we shall overcome. Well, we can hope that Barack Obama will decide to at least have some legislation that would weaken NAFTA, but I don't think so. I don't think he's going to do that. So it's going to be kind of a feel-good change and talk about bumper stickers. But the substance would have been Ron Paul versus Dennis Kucinich. And rather than like 54% of the people turning out to vote, I bet you could have had 85% of the people, because people would realize that both these candidates, although they have differences in social questions like abortion and medical care and what have you, both of them represented what the majority of American people want, beginning with an immediate end to the war in Iraq. Whew. Whoa. All right. Thank you very much, Brian. That kind of stopped me.
I'm even worn out.
Yeah, that wore me out.
You want to take the one final call, Peter?
All right, we'll take another. We got to end in about 4 minutes or so. Here's Jimmy from Bridgewater. Jimmy, are you up around Port Huron?
No, I'm not up around Port Huron. I'm the guy that called in and wanted to hang everybody last week.
Oh, yeah, that's bad. We don't like that.
That is bad, and I was wrong for that.
Well, it's okay.
You were having a moment of anger, and you're saying you're wrong. So how are you feeling this week?
Well, I still want to hang him.
Okay.
you're just not gonna say it.
But after they're found guilty in court.
Well, that's good.
That's
due process.
I work for a lady. I want you to. She is going to win this year in the 7th District United States Congress, right here where I work. I work for her. She's excellent. She knows about NAFTA. She knows about GATT and the WTO and all of that.
Is she a Republican? She's a Republican?
No, she's a Democrat.
Really?
I voted for Ron Paul, so did she.
Okay.
This Republican-Democrat is a bunch of garbage. It's a bunch of crap. It's a way to divide people. And she's trying to bring people together, and she's very smart lady. And you need to wait till her website's up, and you can learn all about the North American Union, the Amero. There was a gentleman that called in shortly after I did that talked about how the Amero's already being printed in Denver.
It is.
This is not a lie. This is not some conspiracy theory. This is a real thing that they're doing.
Well, we obviously can't argue about facts. Either all this is happening or it's not. I tend to think it's not happening. Nothing would surprise me. I don't think there's much in it, though. Here's the deal. I don't think there's much in it for the United States government, and any politician that would advocate that, I think, would be in serious trouble. And they already have it. I mean, to some extent, NAFTA creates a North American Union, right? And they're not interested in borders. The corporate owners, they don't care about borders. They care about profits, right?
They're about trying to... NAFTA was... In the first two words, it was North American Free Trade Agreement. North America. Well, why is it that they're trying to move everything to Mexico? It's so that they can bring in the Chinese slave labor goods and bypass the longshoremen.
Right.
And all of the other things that they want to do. And it's about the destruction of our sovereignty.
Well, it's also about the destruction of these small farms, like, say, in Mexico, where these former farmers are now either, well, they're just probably homeless.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy's right, is that one of the things that the government and the corporations have always been really nervous about is the ability of the International Longshoremen's Association, I think that's the one on the West Coast, to control what comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been historic big battles about this, and he's right. If they bring it in these Mexican ports where they think that there's not going to be any labor unions, but it's going to be like the 1930s in Mexico pretty soon. So they're creating these enormous highways, these NAFTA highways. They're going to bring everything up. So if Jimmy thinks that this North American Union is on the agenda and I don't, it really doesn't matter because for practical purposes, that's what's going on. And Jimmy, I want to thank you for being our last caller. We have to end the show right now. And stay tuned. Got another interview. Not with me this time.
Well, you're doing the interview.
I'm doing the interview.
You'll be there.
I don't even know who it is.
You'll be in the room.
Let me see. Who is it? Somebody good.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, with our friend Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman, who is
a
progressive national radio talk show host.
Right.
And we are colleagues of his. And we're proud to be part of the reason he's even on the air, Peter.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. You can always email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you to Al. And we'll talk to you next week.
This is WRIM.com.
All this mumbo jumbo about music.
It's your riff rock the way you want it.
It's time to get real.
Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIM for your perfect 10 riff rock songs.
Submit your perfect 10 playlist now at WRIM.com.
There's a big computer in there. You like the internet?
It's your call. You can tell us what you want to hear on the riff.
Revolutionizing radio. One listener at a time.
That's one pepper.
Bristol. The WRIF's Perfect 10 playlist. Submit yours now at WRIF.com.
Then listen for your Perfect 10.
Oh, my prayers have been answered.
101 WRIF.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. And I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was, in platform double suede. Yeah, there she was, like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and can't find it here. Who's that lounging? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this Charlotte is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this Charlotte is a dream.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Good morning, and thank you very much. Thank you for joining me. About 15 years ago or so, I interviewed William Ashcroft. Some of you people have been listening for a long time may remember that. The book was called The Late Great Lakes. It said our Great Lakes around us are in pretty dreadful shape unless something remedial is done. We are going to essentially have some dead lakes on our hands. There's a new book out. Dave Dempsey has written it. It's called On the Brink, The Great Lakes in the 21st Century. And Dave Dempsey is the policy advisor for the Michigan Environmental Council. He was an environmental advisor to Michigan Governor James Blanchard, and was appointed by President Clinton to serve on the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. And Dave Dempsey took time out from his vacation in Pennsylvania to join me on the Peter Werby Show. Dave Dempsey, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Peter. Nice to be with you.
Now, what does this say that 15 years ago, actually the book was written 16 years ago, William Ashworth wrote The Late Great Lakes. Was he being a Chicken Little?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of that book. It really was the book that awakened me to the problems the Great Lakes face. I think his prediction was just off by a little bit in terms of time. What we face now are problems that he was predicting then that are just really starting to loom large on our horizon. Our Great Lakes are really in peril, drifting into toward disaster right now.
Well, it's certainly not empirically so. When I go out to any of the lakes that I usually do, Michigan, Huron, Erie primarily, sometimes to Ontario, they seem just fine. I mean, why doesn't it just hit you in the face if it's so dramatic?
Well, for several reasons. First, a lot of the threats are invisible, including some new chemicals that are showing up, a class of fire retardants that are much like the PBBs that were banned in Michigan back in the 70s are showing up in fish and even in human breast milk in women. And the other thing is the threats that are causing the greatest disturbance to the system are below the water, and that's the alien species that are coming in on ships from other continents.
Yeah, well, the fact is, one of the things I wanted to talk about were these invaders into our ecosystem. I mean, now that I'm going to be taking down 8 ash trees on my property, those are airborne, or not airborne, but rather, you know, these beetles that kill the trees here in Michigan, we're going to lose millions of them. Same thing happens. They come in on ships. We during the 50s, there was a large problem with, what were they called, lamprey eels, right?
Right, sea lamprey. Well, they're still here. Actually, when I served in the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, our main job was to make sure there's enough money appropriated every year to control the lamprey. It's always here, and the rule with these alien species is once they get in, you can't get rid of them. You may be able to control them, but you'll never entirely get rid of them. So the Great Lakes, from that perspective, are permanently changed.
Well, why do they have such an impact? I mean, or why don't at least after a while, I mean, if they come in and they don't have any predators and they find a nice place to live, like the zebra mussels and what have you, why after a while isn't there a balance reached where that something takes care of them?
Well, you have to remember the Great Lakes system evolved over 8,000 or 9,000 years since the last glaciers retreated, and the life forms in the lakes evolved in balance with each other. And once you bring in a creature that has no predators here, it can basically take command or at least certainly disrupt the ecosystem. And so we're seeing crashes of some of the favorite sport fish or commercial fish in the Great Lakes, like the yellow perch, a walleye in Lake Erie that are in decline. I guess the rule is you got to keep these invaders out, and the reason we're not doing it is because of powerful industries that benefit from letting them in, and that's the shipping industry and the port industry. That's the rule in the Great Lakes. Our history over 150 years has been that there is always a political force that benefits from short-term exploitation of the lakes, but it costs us all in the long run.
Yeah, well, actually, Dave Dempsey, you took one of my questions away, which, and good for you, which is who in the world would oppose policies and whatever else we need to control all of this? But when I was a kid, the lamprey eels were, you know, everybody was thought that was just going to wipe out the fish in the lakes. How badly did they, what kind of damage did they do, and how eventually, you say, brought under control? How was that accomplished?
Well, it was an amazing thing, really. In just a few short years, the lake trout of Lake Huron went from a catch of over several million pounds to less than 1,000, believe it or not. So it was a huge decline. And there was fear that most of the native fish would be wiped out. So the U.S. and Canada jointly launched this aggressive research effort to figure out a way to control the lamprey. And they found a chemical that appears to mostly target the lamprey. So each year, streams throughout the Great Lakes are treated with this chemical, meaning we have to spend money forever to deal with the lamprey. It's never going to disappear. And the same is true of the more famous zebra mussel, which we spend roughly $1 billion a year in the Great Lakes Basin to control, to keep them from clogging water intakes and doing other damage.
I was going to ask about those little creatures. We don't hear much about the zebra mussel anymore. Are they under control?
No, they're not actually under control. Well, they're under control if you take into account the fact that we're spending billions of dollars over decades to control them. They are not under control. If we let them go, they would rebound. Right now what we have, and I think it should alarm a lot of people who care about the Great Lakes, is a dead zone in Lake Erie that's developing every summer in the last five summers that's happened. That last happened in the 1960s, and it's believed both the zebra mussel and the quagga mussel, by upsetting the Lake Erie ecosystem, have helped contribute to this really depth of the center of the lake.
Well, a lot of sport fishermen probably had their ears perked up, and I don't know who else. What are the impact on all of us? I mean, if there's a dead zone in the middle of Lake Erie, someone might say, well, I go to Point Pelee, I see birds, I sit on the beach, I hike around there, everything looks pretty nice. Why should I care if there's a dead zone in the middle of Lake Erie once a year?
One answer to that would be that divided we fall, united we stand. If we start assuming that parts of the Great Lakes can suffer or degrade and it won't hurt us, I think we're on our way to really giving them up. And remember, it's 18% of the world's surface fresh water, and we've learned in the last 30 years about the interconnection of the ecosystem. So when one element of the Great Lakes condition deteriorates, usually there are others that will follow. Right now, Lake Erie may be a threat only to some people who care about fishing or swimming in the middle of Lake Erie, but the same threats, the alien species and the pollutants are present throughout the basin. And I guess the point of the book is not just to look at what's going on now, but to say there are some really ominous threats looming. One of those would be the threat of climate change. There's models that predict the levels of Lake Huron in Michigan could fall 5 feet in this century, and that's going to have huge impacts on recreational boaters, swimmers, commercial shipping, we're all in this Great Lakes boat together once you look at it that way.
Dave Dempsey is my guest, and the book he mentions that he's the author of is On the Brink, The Great Lakes, The 21st Century. It's published by Michigan State University Press, my almost alma mater. I remember William Ashworth, who we mentioned at the beginning of the show, who wrote kind of a pioneer book, The Late Great Lakes, looking at the problems of our lakes around us. And he, I think I interviewed about his second book, which you may remember the title. It's actually out of my...
Great Lakes Journey?
Great Lakes Journey, and he went around pretty much the perimeter of all the lakes, which is an extraordinary journey. And it occurred to me how much so we take the lakes for granted. I mean, it's because we're all raised here, the ones of us that were. And they, when we want to go to you know, Lake Huron or Lake Michigan, I think the awesome bodies of water that they are just doesn't have perhaps the proper impact on all of us. Or maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but do you think that we perhaps don't comprehend kind of geological entity they are?
Absolutely. I mean, the Great Lakes are a wonder of the world, the natural world, with 18% of the surface fresh water. Just in Michigan alone, we have 3,300 miles of shoreline. One of the points of the book and the point of a lot of the work that I've done at the Michigan Environmental Council is that citizens will decide if the lakes rise or fall. We had a huge outpouring of citizen interest and energy in the Great Lakes in the late 60s and 70s, and that's what drove politicians to pass the Clean Water Act and all the other things that have cleaned up the Great Lakes. They aren't hearing from people now, and that's why the Great Lakes are in decline. So I think it's partly that we take them for granted and partly that this whole society-wide decline in people getting involved in government.
I know there is a body called the International Joint Commission that has some, I don't even know the word I'm looking for, because I don't know if a supervisory capacity is even correct, because we continue to get pollution even though the IJC's mandate is zero pollution, yet it continues. Why does it, well, name some of the, if you would, please, some of the sources of pollution and why they can continue.
Sure. Well, one of the main sources is us. A lot of large communities, including southeast Michigan and Detroit, still flush large amounts of raw sewage into the Great Lakes. And raw sewage includes untreated chemicals. Our sewer systems are antiquated. Secondly, a lot of industries that benefit from fouling the lakes will resist any attempt to control some of those chemicals. This fire retardant problem I mentioned, these chemicals are manufactured by companies in the Great Lakes Basin and then used by companies, and they go into the water and they affect fish and wildlife, and they believe to also impair the development of children, the brain development of children. So industries are not being responsible. And I guess the final concern is a lot of the things that we have already banned here in the Great Lakes are still being used in other parts of the world, and we're learning that the Great Lakes are connected to the atmosphere of even other continents. So even DDT, which Michigan banned first back in 1969, can be found in Great Lakes fish.
I remember telling this little story of mine to William Ashworth when I interviewed him about 15 years ago in terms of our consciousness about what's downstream. And when I was a kid and we used to change our own oil on our cars, we'd dump it down the sewer and say, "Hello, Cleveland." You know, no. I mean, which is pretty hideous when you think about it. We had the consciousness of where it was going. We didn't have any, and we must have thought it negative, or we wouldn't have put that spin on it. But most of us, I mean, I think when you do surveys of people, 90% of the people say that they're concerned about the environment. We ought to live in a pollution-free world, and yet we're not making the progress. I was kind of hesitating to say whether we've made no progress, some progress, or whatever. But if we're on the brink, your title of your book, Dave Dempsey, the consciousness hasn't translated into public policy.
No, it really hasn't. In fact, it's gotten worse. If you look back at the late 60s and 70s, as I said, you can see people, and we documented these citizen heroes in the book who, whether they were car dealers or housewives, as we used to call them, got so furious about a particular pollution problem that they literally wouldn't, they grabbed it like a bulldog and wouldn't let go until somebody passed a law or cleaned it up. We're seeing some of that today, but not nearly as much. And I guess the concern I have is a fear that all of these threats added up are going to overwhelm us. One we haven't talked about is the worldwide shortage of fresh water. And if anybody doubts that the Great Lakes are going to become a canteen for the world, they're deluded. Unless we get our act together as a region and start building walls to protect the water, we're going to be seeing it shipped, whether by canals or barges, to other parts of the U.S. and maybe other continents.
Well, can that happen? Because I know people in Phoenix that are going to run out of water pretty soon within this century are looking towards our water here, but since it's boundary water, I mean, the Great Lakes doesn't belong to the United States and certainly doesn't belong to Michigan. Canada says, well, wait a minute, you're not going to be, aren't they just absolutely adamant that there's never going to be a transshipment of water out of the lakes?
Canada has passed a ban on bulk export of water, but the alarming thing to me is that the state of Michigan is now not just tolerating but actually sanctioning the privatization of water, the bottled water controversy in west central Michigan, where what used to be Perrier, it's now Nestle, has begun bottling and selling Michigan water, implies to many lawyers that I've talked to that water is no longer going to be considered a resource that we all own as the public, but a commodity that companies can sell at their will. And if that happens, no country is going to be able to veto it. We're all aware, I think, of the free trade agreements that basically have knocked down barriers to the shipment of goods across international lines. And that may be where we're headed, and that's a huge worry. There are, I could quote you a lot of politicians, including congressmen from Dick Armand, who believe that Texas, Arizona, Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico are going to need the water, and they'll get it because they have clout in Congress.
Yeah, and that's right. I forgot about things like everything from the Free Trade Acts, NAFTA, and now the FTAA and the World Trade Organization, all of that. You can't just you can't interfere with international trade. So if folks want our water down in Phoenix, even though it's partly Canadian, I guess under these trade rules, they got it.
Once it's established as a commodity, that's true.
Yeah.
And I guess what I want to emphasize is that Michigan has so much to do with the rise and fall of the Great Lakes in this century. We're the only state entirely in the Great Lakes Basin. Every other state, and there are seven others in the U.S. that has some Great Lakes shoreline, has divided loyalties. We have states like Ohio and Indiana that want to divert Great Lakes water because part of their land base is outside the Great Lakes. So we're going to have to be the strongest and most unflinching advocate of the lakes, which I'm not sure we're always being these days.
Dave Dempsey, I have had the pleasure of hosting the annual State of the Detroit River Boat Tours that are sponsored by the Citizens Environment Alliance, centered mostly in Windsor, but also a presence here in southeast Michigan. And we're going to be doing another tour on September 18th. And one of the things that we do on these tours is certainly to point out all the problem spots and all of the, what needs protecting. But we also talk about victories and what has been accomplished and a few spots that have remained pristine. In your travels around the Great Lakes and thinking about and writing your book On the Brink, tell us the best and the worst. Let's at least start off with the best. When you, hopefully there is something you can answer to this. Are there bright spots in our Great Lakes?
Oh, there are huge bright spots. If you look at the mess that we were in 30 years ago, we really dealt with the obvious problems. Phosphorus levels are down over 70%, and that's because government, responding to citizens, banned phosphorus in laundry detergents, or at least strictly limited it. We've got a number of cleanups underway of some of the most contaminated areas in the Great Lakes Basin. Some of the harbors like Milwaukee, Saginaw Bay, and others are being cleaned up, and we're seeing fisheries come back. We're seeing a lot more citizen activism in the sense of water monitoring programs that involve volunteers. There's a woman up in the Sheboygan area of Michigan who has made it her duty to guard the very rare, very unique, and very exotic, in a good way, a lake sturgeon from being decimated. She gets out there with volunteers every spring to make sure that they're not poached. And, you know, these are fish that can grow to 6 feet long and live over 100 years, so they're quite a majestic part of the system. So I would say the bright spots are the citizen energy here and there. I think the worst is probably the growing callousness on the part of our governments toward the future of the lakes, whether it be Ohio and Indiana wanting to divert Great Lakes water, or right now the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is basically studying whether or not we should spend billions of dollars to bring in more ocean-going vessels and therefore more alien species and further disrupt the Great Lakes. So we've got government as the enemy in many cases.
Hmm. Now, actually, both of those were good answers. I was interested more sort of empirically. What if, when you go out there and you look at something and you say, this is the way it should be, you know, physically. This is where I want to go. This is where I want to take my family. Or the opposite, when you go somewhere and look and say, I can't believe that humans have done this to nature.
Okay, I think the best, an example of the best would be the restoration of Northern Lake Michigan. There's a particularly great project in the Traverse City area, a watershed project run by one of the local officials that has begun addressing the root sources, everything from the used oil that you were talking about to storm sewers. And the bay is in really healthy shape because of that. And there's a lot of economic benefit coming to the community.
It looks extraordinarily beautiful to me. In fact, that going up, I can't remember, all of a sudden the route up to Northport is out of my brain that goes out of the out of Traverse City. But it is an extraordinary beautiful ride. So it's good to know that there's nothing, as you said earlier, lurking beneath the surface of any real danger. And where would we go or not go to see something really awful and frightening?
Well, the visible area might be northwest Indiana along Lake Michigan, where you can just on a summer day smell the pollution in the air and see the way in which the shoreline has been really devoured by ugly industrial development. But I have to say, closer to home and under the water, the Detroit River is a very serious problem, not just because of the raw sewage that I mentioned, but also there are tons and tons of mercury and PCB contaminated bottom muds in the river that need to be cleaned up, and there's really nothing going on that right now.
Well, when I've kayaked on the Detroit River or just been on something like Belle Isle with my dog, I see people fishing, and I think, I don't know if I'd like to eat these fish that are coming out of that river. Would you eat them, Dave Dempsey?
The Detroit River?
Yeah.
I would eat them guardedly. I think the most concern I would have would be for women of childbearing age and kids because of the PCB and mercury issues. PCBs, in a landmark study done by folks at Wayne State, have delay the brain development of young kids. So as a 47-year-old white male who's a tough old buzzard, I guess I have less concern about myself, but I do think women of childbearing age, basically in the Great Lakes region, should very, very strictly limit their consumption of Great Lakes fish.
Well, you know, I traveled on a Greenpeace boat one summer up and down the Great Lakes. They were touring it, and I remember that I told one of the people on board that I had swam in four of the five Great Lakes that summer, and they looked at me, and I think they were from either Germany or Sweden. They said, I would not swim in any of it. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that bad, is it?
No, swimming in most areas of the lakes is quite safe. And again, I think when I say on the brink, as the title of my book, I want to stress it means we're on the threshold either of the final fall and degradation of the lakes, or if we wake up as citizens, I think we can show the world that the Great Lakes can be a model for how you live in harmony with the environment. But too many of our attitudes toward the lakes are still based on what I think of as 19th century thinking that we can improve the lakes or we can manipulate them or we can rearrange them to suit our will. And every time we've done that, we've had unanticipated disasters result. I mean, I'm sure everybody, many people can remember when the Rouge River in Detroit, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland caught fire, and that's the kind of thing that we thought would never happen. Mm-hmm. The fallacy of the Great Lakes for most people is we look at them and we go, they're so big, we couldn't possibly affect them. The lumber barons of Michigan thought the same thing in the 1850s, that we had so much timber it could last forever no matter how much we cut, and they cut it down in one generation. I think we can also see that we're so numerous we could dramatically degrade the Great Lakes in one generation.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left, and I can't begin to tell you how many times I use this phrase towards the end of interviews, and that is the political will.
Dave Dempsey, you've written this incredible book, On the Brink, The Great Lakes in the 21st Century, clarion call to let us know what the potentials for disaster are. But at the same time, you expressed a concern during this interview that the popular will isn't there. We have these large mega forces with extraordinary amounts of money that part of that have a vested interest in continuing things as they are, a recipe for disaster. How do we find the popular or political will to change things? I mean, you've done your part. What else can be done?
Well, two things have to happen. One is citizens need to mobilize. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy to say that the system is out of control and we can't do anything about it. If citizens don't show up or raise heck about the problem, then nothing will happen. I guess the other thing that I think is important, and I guess it's, I would certainly favor campaign finance reform so a lot of the powerful interests that benefit from fouling the Great Lakes would be brought to heel. But we've got to bring democracy closer to people. And one of the ideas in the book and in a related study that I did for the Michigan Environmental Council is to start going to citizens instead of asking citizens to go to faraway places in the Great Lakes Basin. We need to have sort of a Great Lakes capital on the Internet where people can log in and directly communicate with their legislators is just one example. We've got to really rethink democracy is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think that's extraordinarily important for every aspect of this society. I mean, we're ostensibly a democratic society, but more and more elites rule our lives and our environment. Well, I want to thank you for sharing your time with us, Dave Dempsey. I know you took time out from your vacation. Let me just read what former Governor William Milliken, Governor of Michigan, said. Remember when there were moderate Republicans? He says, the Great Lakes, I won't ask you for a response. The Great Lakes are a global treasure that we take for granted at our own peril. In this book, Dave Dempsey contrasts the majesty of the Great Lakes and the affection shown them by individuals with the history of their neglect and mistreatment by government and others. So, as I said just a minute ago, the warning is here. The rest is up to us. And I was looking on the literature for a website. I see the MSU press.msu.edu website. Is there any one that links directly to your book?
Yeah, the MSU Press site does that. And there's also a site, my author's site, davedempsey.org.
All right. And I will put that on my website as well. So, Dave Dempsey, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed it.
In WRIF.com. When you're ahead of the digital curve, sometimes you have to toot your own horn. Proudly streaming worldwide since 1997 at WRIF.com. And now you can also hear our HD2 sister station.
What's the name of this place?
RIF2 at RIF2.com. Everything that rocks.
Still my day away. There's so much.
Pepsi want to help you update your stuff with Pepsi stuff, music, and more. Just tune into The Rip or log on WRIF.com for your chance to get great stuff, including a 42-inch plasma TV, Zoom digital media players, digital cameras, and Amazon.com gift cards from PepsiStuff.com, where every sip gets you closer to your choice of choice stuff. And 101 WRIF.
Everything rocks.
Rocks.
All right, $9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me.
By my 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 ahead. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at The Rip. Get your request, content info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And,
I'm sorry.
But we'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
The Rip.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. You may remember, it seemed like only a matter of weeks ago, that I had an author, a distinguished author, a syndicated talk show host, Tom Hartman, on this program. I told him, Tom, you write some books, we'll get you on the air. I don't know if this is the impetus, but it seems like Tom Hartman is putting out a new book every 6 weeks. Tom Hartman, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
I don't have anything to do with you writing these books, do I? I mean, knowing that you can always get it on here in Detroit. I mean,
that's why I have to do it, Peter. This is the only way I can get on your show, you know?
All right. Now I try
to call up my publishers and say, "Hey, get another one here."
Well, the last one we spoke about was the Edison gene, about ADD and ADHD.
Right.
But also, we've talked to you about your book, Unequal Protection: The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, ADHD, Secrets of Success. I'm sure, I know there was a couple others as well.
Yeah.
Now, as I would always be with my audience, and particularly with you, always honest, when you told me that you were publishing a book that, the fancy name is illustrated book, often called a comic book, I kind of said, what? I got to tell you, Tom Hartman, this really hits it. I mean, to the point where I think about all the dense text that I've been through. The name of the book is We the People, A Call to Take Back America. It's illustrated by Neil Cohn. Is that how you say it? Or Cohn, which is it?
Cohn, yeah.
Cohn. Neil Cohn. And this would take like 10 volumes, many of which you've previously written before, to summarize. Congratulations on this. This is a fine piece of work.
Thank you. It's a really good, clean, solid history of the founding of America, and the big battles between particularly Madison and Jefferson, or Jefferson and Adams, and how those battles are still being played out today between Democrats and Republicans, and the differing visions of democracy and what democracy means and how it's different from traditional forms of government, and how our democracy is being stolen in ways that it's been stolen before by, for example, Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, and what we can do to take it back.
Well, you, like, and much like me, people always say we say the damnedest things or the most radical things in the calmest voice, and I was going to bring that up, that it's one thing to see the forms of democracy that were intended to administer this country begin to erode and they have at different periods, but to evoke the most undemocratic forms of, well, the 20th century, that of fascism and Nazism, that seems in many ways to go way beyond the Tom Hartman I know, the kind of moderate, what is the radical center, what is your phrase?
The radical middle.
The radical middle, yeah. So tell me about fascism. How could it apply here? There's no stormtroopers around.
Well, then you haven't. If you think not, then you haven't shown up for a Bush event. the reality is that, you know, my notion of the radical middle is that most people want a government which is of, by, and for we the people. That on the one hand doesn't create some sort of massive nanny state, to use the right winger's phrase. We don't want to reinvent the communism light or, you know, the USSR light. On the other hand, laissez-faire capitalism, you know, pure, unrestrained economic dog-eat-dog, Ayn Randianism, is
is equally toxic and equally destructive. And those are both kind of economic systems. Now you get into the political system, and the whole idea of the founding of the of this country was to balance the dynamic tension between those two, between the needs of society, the social contract that we all have with each other, protecting the commons, taking care of the least among us, protecting the rights of minorities, to balance that with making sure that people have an opportunity to do what they want in their lives, to have, you know, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and to make a living, you know, and even to get rich here in America.
Well,
and, you know, and so it's like, how do you do that? And there's this middle road, as it were, which I call the radical middle, you know, today would be called radical liberalism, but I think back in 1940, 1950, it would have been considered mainstream thought in America.
Well, let's go back to, I think I took you astray with the radical middle, and that is what I said about fascism. And when you said, have you gone to a George Bush event? Yeah, all of a sudden you're pushed into a so-called free speech zone. You're surrounded by robocops, and that's what I mean. There are points in our history or methods of projecting the power of the state that seems inconsistent with democracy. But then, on the other hand, to go as far to say that it's Mussolini and Hitler, I mean, gee, that seems like a leap.
Well, what I think most people don't understand, Peter, is that Mussolini invented a new form of government, which is really nothing new. It went back, it goes way back. I mean, there's three historic ways that humans have been ruled. We've either been ruled, I mean, through the 7,000 years of modern civilization, setting aside tribal people who have always been, by and large, democratic and egalitarian, but what we call civilization. We've either been ruled by warlord kings who rule by threat of violence. We've been ruled by popes or theocrats or you know, in the old biblical days, kings who had religious authority, who were ruled because God told them to or anointed them. We've been ruled by the rich, which is a system of governance called feudalism. In 1066, in 1514, or 1415, 1215, when King John was forced to sign the Magna Carta, that was the high point, not of the beginning of human rights, as many people think, and is unfortunately implied in many of our elementary school textbooks, but that was the high point of feudalism. That, you know, what had happened was the rich landowners went to King John and they said, well, you think you're the king and you think you're the big shot, but we really are the ones who own the land and we really have the power. And you're going to have to do what we say from now on. And you're going to have to give us rights. And in fact, you're going to have to give us the right to control you and how you behave. And King John was essentially forced to sign the Magna Carta. And now people like you and me, I mean, you know, the working folks, the peons, as it were, the serfs, got no rights whatsoever. They were still the property of the feudal lords. So that was the height of feudalism. So feudalism could be broadly defined as government being taken over by the rich, ruled by the rich through the appearance of government. In other words, King John appeared to be the guy who was the king, but the feudal lords are really running the show after the Magna Carta was signed and right up into the 16th and 17th centuries, or 14th and 15th anyway. And then the feudal lords were replaced by corporations who continued to run the show, you know, the East India Company and all that kind of thing. And so what Mussolini came up with was what he called originally corporatism in 1929, this idea that corporations had great power, great economic power, and the state had great political power and the ability to control police and army, and that you should combine the two and use the power of the police and the armies to protect the interests of the corporations and use the economic wealth and power of the corporations to control the people, rather than using the force of government to control the people. And he called that first corporatism, and then a few years later he invented this word fascism, which was from the Italian fasce, which was the bundle of sticks with an axe sticking out of the top of it, which was the official symbol of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire back, you know, 2,000 years ago.
Now, where have I seen that before? I think it's on the dollar bill.
Well, there's also one in the United States Senate on one of the podiums. Actually, there's a fasce.
Yeah, so it's actually E Pluribus Unum, right? Out of many, one.
Yeah, out of many, one. I mean, on the dollar bill, you see in one hand the olive branch that the eagle is holding, and in the other hand, you see 13 arrows. You know, arrows. So it's not quite the fasce, but the fasce itself, the actual technical, literal fasce, does appear, carved into the wood in the United States
Senate. It's a couple hundred years old.
Yeah.
But anyhow, Mussolini came up with this, and Hitler adopted it in large part, bringing business in. In fact, the very first concentration camp, 3 months after he came to power, sort of like Guantanamo Bay type, you know, it was just for enemy combatants, people who were outside the purview of the Geneva Conventions and not prisoners of war and had no rights, was built in Oranienburg, Germany, by a corporation that was a major contributor to Hitler's campaigns, just like Halliburton built Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo Bay and just got a huge multimillion-dollar contract to expand it. And this merging of corporate and state interests was the key to the early successes of Hitler. It certainly was the key to the successes of Franco in Spain and Mussolini in Italy. And it is what we are seeing now today. So in a very literal sense, I mean, people think of fascism as jackbooted thugs and ovens in which Jews are put to death and things like that. It's not. That was the consequence of, you know, a madman running a political system amok. Fascism, literally, the dictionary definition is the merging of state and corporate interests, and that's what we are seeing, and we have ever since Reagan became president. I mean, it's the overtly, it's what's called the conservative agenda, and it literally is fascism, and fascism is rising in the United States more rapidly now than it has at any time, except possibly during the Gilded Age.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Tom Hartman, author of We the People, A Call to Take Back America. It's an illustrated book. It's absolutely incredible. Neil Cohn did the illustrations. It's published by Corway Media, Inc. How's the best way to get it, Tom? Is it going to be in bookstores, or should we go to your website?
Amazon sells it. My website just links to that or to Corway's website. BarnesandNoble.com. All the online bookstores sell it. Unfortunately, we have not yet gotten distribution in the major chains. They can all order it. You can go into a Barnes & Noble store and order it, and 3 or 4 days later they'll have it for you. And we're trying to work it out now where they'll actually inventory the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough. Corway's a small publisher. A lot of my books have been published by bigger publishers, you know, like Random House, and they can just, you know, kind of steamroll them in. But Corway's still working on it. So I encourage people to actually go to their local bookstore, particularly an independent bookstore, but if all that's available is a BNN, do that. And just order the book, and it'll come in a couple days later. And you know,
why did you want to do an illustrated, what sometimes called a comic book, as opposed to what you've done in the past? I mean, so much of what you've written, Unequal Protection and The Last Days of Ancient Sunlight, have had a great impact on people. Although it takes a certain level these days, particularly everyone's used to People Magazine and television, to actually dive into a book that doesn't have any pictures. It's just all type. But that's where
most people don't even have the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this book is great bathroom reading. You know, you can pretty much open it anywhere and just, boom, get right into one of the stories because, you know, the chapters all pretty much stand alone, although there is a chronology to it. And I thought it was just remarkably accessible. I mean, it's not a book for kids, although I think anybody over 8 years old could read it and fully understand it. It really is a book for adults, and it's a book that adults can sit down and read in a few hours. It's 200 and some odd pages, but there's just, you know, not, and I don't mean this to pat myself on the head, but I mean there's just, we put a lot of effort to Neil Burke, who edited it as well, to just compress an enormous amount of information into a small space, and so it's very dense, actually.
But you're right. It reads well. I mean, you can actually almost in some cases read individual panels and find out startling information or summations of larger bodies of thought. So I think it's very valuable in that regard. And there's Tom Hartman leading the masses. I know you don't aspire on the cover. On the cover.
I'm now a cartoon character, Peter.
yeah. Let me get back a little to fascism and classic fascism as to what could be a neo-corporate fascism. And that is to say that a couple of things that one doesn't expect in under fascism. One is dissent and two is elections. And first, going on the along the lines of dissent, I mean, here is Tom Hartman broadcasting. Tom is also, I think I said that earlier, a nationally syndicated talk show host. You can go to his site under his name and find his times. And here am I, you know, broadcasting on this station. And so I'd say, well, wait a minute. If we have fascism, how come we got Hartman and Werby and Earth First and people going to be showing up at the Republican National Convention, to say boo to Bush? I mean, that doesn't sound like fascism to me. That sounds like good old-fashioned democracy.
Well, there were protest movements against Hitler in the early days, too. Hitler, I mean, you know, what we have to be clear about is that Hitler went beyond fascism. Hitler started with fascism, ended up with a dictatorship, essentially. Mussolini, not quite so badly. Franco, nowhere near as much. But the reality is that if we're talking about pure fascism, which is a merger of corporate and state interests, then you have to maintain the illusion of democracy. You still let people vote. You still allow dissenting voices. But if the corporations are controlling the commons, if the corporations are controlling, for example, the vote by controlling the voting machines, or if they're controlling the airwaves and so they're controlling the information, then you allow on essentially what is token dissent and point to it and say, see, aren't we liberal? Mm-hmm. In the classical sense, aren't we broad-minded? And we're allowing dissenting views, and it just appears nobody wants to hear them. That was what, for example, MSNBC was saying when they fired Phil Donahue before the memo was leaked that he was fired for political reasons and that he had the highest ratings of any show on MSNBC, including Chris Matthews' show, which was regularly beating CNN. And so I see this growth of corporate power, particularly in the media, which is explicitly against the law in the United States, by the way. These are all violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act and other laws, since then, of corporate media, owning newspapers all across the United States, owning radio stations and television stations all across the United States. This incredible concentration of media where, 14 companies control 90% of all magazines that are published in the United States and read. There's just a small handful of book publishers. This is the friendly face of fascism. It's really an economic/political system where the power of government to, as Jefferson idealized, to hold back the power of wealth is increasingly and steadily diminished, so that wealth rises up, takes control, and promotes laws that benefit itself. It cuts its own taxes. It makes people work harder and harder for less and less money. It makes them more and more insecure, so they're less willing to rebel or to speak out or to fight back. And there's this continuous, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, kind of revolving door between the political side and the corporate side, as we're seeing, every day, particularly with the Bush administration. I mean, they've been so blatant about it, but they the Clinton administration were not angels, and certainly the Bush-Reagan administrations were the first to really, really embrace this in a big way.
Well, Tom Hartman, talk to me a little about elections. I was talking with the syndicated columnist, Alexander Coburn, a couple of weeks ago, and he said, well, here's the way elections look now. He said, progressive people go into a voting booth. They say, I don't like either party, so I'm going to vote for Ralph Nader. You get in there and you say, I don't want Bush to win. So you vote for the Democratic Party candidate, and then the machine registers it for Bush. So you have this progression through all three. How secure, in your estimation, and I know you talk about it in your book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America, that these new touch-tone voting machines really represent a threat to the last vestiges of democratic participation in elections?
Well, clearly they're not secure. Clearly they've been hacked. I'm strongly of the opinion that the election in Georgia, for example, in 2002 was hacked and rigged
and stolen.
And there's no way to audit that because there's no paper trail.
But no, but stolen? Would you say then? Would you use
stolen?
Okay,
sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm on the record as let them challenge me.
Tell us the story that you relate in your book, We the People, about Chuck Hagel. I think
that's where it began. You know, he was the first guy. He was the president of ES&S, the big election machine company. He sold those machines all over the state of Nebraska, and then quit his job and ran for senator from Nebraska. And in what the Washington Post called the upset election of the year, he defeated a popular incumbent Democrat by winning districts that had never in history, you know, or in 40 years, voted Democratic. Black districts, you know, working collar, blue collar working districts that had always voted Democratic. And when I wrote a story about it for Common Dreams 2 years ago, and Bev Harris did a piece about it, and The Hill picked it up, and we heard from their reporter that Hagel had actually sent a staffer down to threaten him with legal action if he told the story, which he did. But it was kind of a one-day wonder. I mean, you know, it was considered a small scandal at that point because he'd been in Congress for 6 years by then, 7 years. But, I think that there is a very real problem with security. On the other hand, the security problem, I think, is diminishing because more and more people are becoming aware of these and more people are starting to speak up, and there's this real groundswell. And so I think that leads us to C, which is the big problem, and that is that in the last election, in the 2002 election, some 1.7 million votes didn't get counted because they were, quote, spoiled. The machines didn't count them right. The machines didn't boot right. When somebody tried to turn the machine on, the password didn't work. The machines crashed in midstream. You know, all kinds of things that were just, you would think, these are just, hey, this is just, you know, stuff happens, right? The problem is that the vast majority of those happened in minority neighborhoods that historically vote Democratic. And very few of these happened in the white suburbs, particularly in the upper economic white suburbs, almost none of them. And it was the same companies with the same machines, the same, you know, repair guys, the same installers. And it wasn't because black people are incapable of pushing a button. These were, you know, the mythology that the right-wingers have been promoting ever since Florida is, you know, that they're just, you know, this implicit racism, you know, that they're just not as smart. It's nonsense. It has nothing to do with that. These were machines failing independent of the voters, and they just, by some huge coincidence, well over a million votes, simply never got registered in largely black districts across the United States.
Well, Tom, what's the message?
That's frankly, to me, more insidious than somebody hacking in.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot easier to do.
I mean,
all they got to do is every 2 or 3 hours go over and unplug the machine from the wall and plug it back in. It reboots and it forgets all the votes that have been cast.
Yeah, if it wasn't for that process and the ability to hand the Senate to the Republicans, and there was like a 1% voting total difference between the two parties in 2002, it wasn't any landslide, history could have been much different. We might not be in the absolute total mess we're in Iraq right now. You know, we have actually 2 minutes left. And, of course, we look at your book, We the People, A Call to Take Back History, as you say, it covers a sweep of quite a bit of time. But what you last told me, if I was listening, I might say, you know what, I'm like the rest of the 50% of people in America in elections in a presidential, I'm not going to vote. And not even, I mean, it's bad enough that often these candidates look the same. And now I hear Tom Hartman saying that these crooks might not even count my ballot.
Well, and that's the problem. That's why it's so important to get people active about this. And, in fact, one of the main reasons why you're seeing the Republicans running so many negative ads is that research in the last 4 years has shown that negative ads do not have the effect of causing people to change their vote to, in other words, Bush running negative ads against Kerry don't cause people to vote for Bush. They cause people to not vote.
Hmm.
And that's what they want. Negative ads are designed to drive down the number of people who are voting. They just shrug their shoulders and say a curse on all of them, and that's the only way the Republicans can win, because they, at least these right wing cranks who call themselves Republicans, because they really represent a small minority in the United States.
And of course, their stalwarts, their core, will come out. I mean, what they're hoping.
Oh, yeah.
They're hoping that people like, I mean, well, and you tell me if I'm speaking accurately, if I'm saying we, but people like us who aren't anywhere near completely satisfied with John Kerry. He you know, people have called him Bush Light. People have said that it's simply the lesser of the two evils. But Noam Chomsky has said, if you have a lesser of two evils, take it.
Yeah. Well, and what we can expect to see, I think, in the next 6 months from the Bush campaign is there will be attack ads targeted toward middle-of-the-roaders and conservatives saying that John Kerry's the most liberal guy ever, and there will be attack ads targeted against you, people like you and me, saying John Kerry, you know, really isn't a true liberal. He really just says what has to, you know, what he thinks mm-hmm. is going to get him elected, blah, blah, blah. So that both groups will choose not to go to the polls, and that's the real hope. That's about the only hope the Republicans have right now, and we have to see through that. We have to get people engaged and get them active. We must.
Yeah, I saw an ad, and I rarely watch television, saw an ad last night saying that John Kerry is more liberal than Hillary Clinton and Ted Kennedy. Ooh.
Yeah, and if that's true, then who the hell needs Ralph Nader? Pardon my language.
All right, Tom Hartman, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show. Go to Tom Hartman's website. I'm not going to spell it for you, because if you spell it anyway, you will get to Tom Hartman's website. It's T-H-O-M, just said I wouldn't, H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N. Tom has a nationally syndicated daily talk show, tons of terrific books. The latest, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Tom, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
This is WRIM.com.
Hello.
How are you?
Hey, it's Joe Mike, and Monday morning our guest will be comedian Chris Rock, who's coming to the Fox Theater Friday, February 29th, and Saturday, March 1st. Also Monday, we'll talk with John Wilson, who created the Razzie Awards, which takes place Oscar Eve, February 23rd. Enjoy your weekend, all that and more Monday morning with us, Joe Mike on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Yeah, all right, I'll see you guys there.
Joe and Mike, weekday mornings on the Rare. No subscription necessary. 101 WRIF. Everything.
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now the moment you've been waiting for.
Back and forth or less.
Don't forget to tune in 101
WRIF.
This is really good.
The Rare.
Conversations with you kept me out tonight. I've been waiting for this. Contradictions all I have. Resist you. I've lost all confidence.
Go on the air from one end of the camp to the other.
Oh, my gosh.
Pick up that mic.